And with that, members, good morning. Welcome to the first meeting of the State Government Finance and Elections Conference Committee. With that, Ms. Spreck, can you take the roll?
Chair Nelson.
I'm here.
Chair Kiffmeyer.
Present.
Representative Nash.
Present.
Senator Carlson.
Present.
Representative Greenman.
Present.
Senator Howe.
Present.
Senator Curran. Senator Lang.
Present.
Representative Mason. Looks like she's having some issues with her Zoom. Representative Zhang.
Here.
Representative Mason, are you present? I see you're on there. A quorum is present.
Thank you. Members, this morning what we're probably going to get through is what we're going to have the staff do the walkthrough. But before we do that, I'd like the members to introduce themselves and say a little bit about themselves so we get to know you on the House side. And with that, I'll start with the senators. Chair Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. I appreciate the opportunity to join you today and welcome everybody to this first State Government Conference Committee. Important work and glad to be part of it. And I represent Senate District 30, which is the eastern part of Sherburn and Wright counties, which includes Big Lake, Elk River, Otsego, Albertville, St. Michael, Hanover, and 14 homes in Dayton. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Curious how you got 14 homes in Dayton, but that's how redistricting goes.
Exactly.
Next, Senator Lang.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senator Andrew Lang, I'm from southwestern Minnesota. I represent four counties that consist of Kanduhai, Chippewa, Swift, and Renville counties. This is my second term. I am involved heavily in ag and environment finance and policy. I've been on the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council for 4 years. I serve on the state's Emergency Medical Service Regulatory Board. And I was just this year named the chairman of the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee. So happy to be with you. I'm looking forward to a good conference.
Thank you, sir. Next, I have Senator Howell.
Well, thank you. Good to be here again on state government. I think I know quite a few of the folks from the House, so it's good to be here. I actually hail from District 13, which basically wraps around St. Cloud. So I don't represent any of St. Cloud, but wrap around it. So good to be here. Look forward to accomplishing a lot of good work.
Thank you, Senator Howell. Next to Senator Curran. And he was the one that I think they didn't give another second here. If not, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Carlson, and I'm the senator from the South Metro. I represent Burnsville and Egan, all in Dakota County. And I'm in my, 13th year, and I'm happy to be on this committee because I think we have a lot of work to do. And I see a lot of faces that I've known for a long time, and I look forward to working with everybody that is new to conference committees. And I think we've said this before, but this is going to be unique. It is going to be something we've never done before. So looking forward to it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Next, I'll go with Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jim Nash. This is my fourth term, seventh year on this committee. Second time serving on the conference committee for this committee, and have enjoyed every minute of it and look forward to a good conference committee where we can get to work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Representative Nash. And members, if you can turn your camera on when you speak so the public can see who you are, and if possible, I know some people have if they're not in the Capitol, might have problems with their internet. But if you can turn your camera on when you're speaking, at least that would be helpful. Next, I have Representative Greenman.
Good morning, Representative Emma Greenman, and I represent 63B, really grateful to be here. That is South Minneapolis and Eastern Richfield, and the unincorporated territories that include Fort Snelling. So I have the Fort Snelling, the airport, and the VA hospital, all of which I think are critical to this committee. So I'm excited to be here and to get to work.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Next, Representative Zhang, T.
Hello, I'm Representative Tu Zhang. It's my second term. I'm from House District 53A, Maplewood, Woodbury, Oakdale, and Landfall, sort of the eastern metro suburbs here. And it's a privilege and honor to be part of this committee. And look forward to working with all of you.
And Representative Zhang is sitting in for, is going to be in place of Representative Eklund, who's the chair of the Vets Committee. Representative Zhang is the vice chair, so he's going to be taking the lead on some of those issues. Representative Mason, are you able to get back?
Good morning.
You're muted.
Okay, hopefully you hear me.
Yeah, now you were unmuted, then you muted yourself again, so.
I'm Sandra Mason. I represent 51A, which is most of Western Eagan and all of Northern Burnsville. So thank really you. Excited to be here.
Thank you, Representative. And lastly, myself, I'm on chair of the State Government Finance Committee in the House. I represent 40A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park, is my district. And this is my 10th term. Members. So anyway, with that, members, we'll get started with the walkthroughs. We'll start with the spreadsheet.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Okay. I see Senator Curran is on. Did we? I think it was just a little bit late, but if we didn't get to him yet, it might be good to do so.
I thank you for that, Senator Curran. We were introducing ourselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Senator Mark Curran, represent Senate District 32, Chisago and Isani counties, about 40 miles north of the state capital. But I was born and raised my family in St. Paul, just about five blocks west of the capital. So happy to be here.
Thank you, Senator Curran. If you can, when you speak, if you can have your camera on, that'd be great. Also, you were very soft, so I don't know if you can turn your speaker up or speak better into your microphone. We could barely hear you, but thank you for being here. With that, do we get everybody? With that, we'll start with the spreadsheets. Ms. Roberts and Mr. Erickson, we can walk through the spreadsheets on the bill. And I think Ms. Roberts was going to share her screen and put it up.
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. I'm Helen Roberts from the House Fiscal Staff, and I'm going to share the spreadsheet. This spreadsheet is a part of the bigger spreadsheet that was also posted with the committee docs. And it shows the Senate and House positions only. If you want the additional detail, again, that is posted on the committee website. And I'll let Mr. Erickson start.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Andrew Erickson with Senate Council Research and Fiscal Analysis. I think Helen and I will kind of pass it back and forth. I'll start with the legislature, and then we'll move back and forth by agency as we go through this. So first in the legislature, you'll see that the Senate makes a series of direct appropriations and riders that are within the legislature's section. There's a $3.667 million biennial appropriation for the Senate as an operating adjustment. There's also an operating adjustment for the LCC of $180,000, which grows into the tails to meet some accessibility standards that the legislature is required to comply with. Beginning in 2025. There is a base adjustment for the Legislative Budget Office, which had previously seen its base decrease in the current biennium compared to the previous biennium. There is a bit of funding, $360,000 biennially, for the Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity, And finally, there is a $500,000 one-time appropriation for an election audit that is required of the legislative auditor in the elections article. Oh, excuse me. And before I pass it over to Ms. Roberts, I'll also just call attention to the bottom lines of the legislature. You'll see that there's also a statutory appropriation that is being made for the legislative auditor out of the state data security account. This is an account that has been created and collecting money for some time, but has not been appropriated out of thus far. There's also a change in a statutory transfer. It's in statute for local impact notes. It comes out of property tax aids and credits and currently goes to MMB. The Senate bill redirects that appropriation to the LBO, who is now responsible for local impact notes. That's a $207,000 annual transfer.
Moving over to the House position for the legislature, the House bill was amended on the House floor to do a significant change to the funding for the legislature as a whole. And so the House bill now has statutory appropriations for the House, the Senate, and the LCC. So the numbers that you see here on the House side represent the amounts that are estimated to be needed by the House, the Senate, and the LCC. I'd point out, for example, there's a difference of $200,000 between the Senate and the House, and that is because the House funding through an open appropriation would pick up $200,000 that the Senate had planned to spend out of its carry forward account. And you will also see when you look at the side-by-side language that the House position includes the authorization for these statutory appropriations. I'll note that in brackets, you will see the legislative budget office space adjustment, and I just put that on there to make it clear that the House position does fund that amount in the open appropriation for the LCC. Finally, there is one direct appropriation in the House bill for the Commission on the Mass Demonstration Response Review, and that's $750,000 in one-time funding, and there is some language related to this in Article 2. Moving down to these carry-forward lines, the House position, the House bill repeals the carry-forward accounts for the legislature, so these are the amounts that are estimated that would be unspent from those accounts at the end of this fiscal year. And so we're showing those as a gain to the general fund because those amounts would be canceled. And that is it for the legislature. Moving on to the state auditor, the House position funds the state auditor at $3 million over base. This is largely the request from the auditor and the governor's recommendation. The only difference is that the funding for the school finance accountability team is lower than what the auditor had requested.
And on the Senate side, there is a security improvement one-time appropriation of $63,000, which is what the governor requested. And moving to the Attorney General, there's also a $200,000 security improvement appropriation. It's for the same purposes that the governor had requested in his revised recommendations, but at a lower level.
Moving on to the House side for the Attorney General, the House has $11.76 million in an increase over base. This represents what the Attorney General and the governor had requested, with the exception of the criminal enforcement and initiatives line, which is $500,000 less than the request. And then I'll move down to the Secretary of State's office. For the House, you can see the funding as requested for the various initiatives for business services, security improvements, safe at home, and the civil engagement and youth outreach. And then on the second, moving on to the second page, there were two legislator member initiatives funded in the House bill. The first is one-time funding of $48,000 for voting instructions in non-English languages, and the second is $500,000 in one-time funding for grants for bilingual election judges. And then also the House bill has additional funding of $29,000 from the Special Revenue Fund. This is additional HABA funding that was released by the federal government to the state. And there is a statutory appropriation of all HAVA funds included in the elections article on the House, in the House bill.
And then on the Senate side, oh, Helen, or Ms. Roberts, could you scroll up just a little bit?
Sorry.
Thanks. The Senate position is carrying a number of pieces for the Secretary of State. One is a, as with the other constitutional offices, a one-time appropriation for security improvements at a lower level than what the governor had requested. In this case, $16,000 one-time. Carrying the governor's ask for the Safe at Home program, a one-time appropriation relating to modifying how business addresses are displayed on the Secretary of State website. This was a Senator Housley bill. There is a one-time appropriation in fiscal 21 to implement various election provision changes that are in Article 4 that will be detailed later by the elections attorney for the committee. There's also some election equipment grant money, $19.5 million in the current biennium, which is decreased in the tails. And then finally, there's no additional HAVA funding, as Ms. Roberts had pointed out, but there is a provision that modifies previous HAVA appropriations so that anything that was appropriated in the 2020 HAVA money or the HAVA CARES tranches of money is being redirected for the use of election equipment grants instead of the or modifying the previous uses that were described in a session law last year. Ms. Roberts, I think we'll kick it back to you as the Senate doesn't have any changes in the next several agencies.
Yes, for the next three agencies on the House side are all small agencies, and the House position was to fund the requested operating adjustments for all three. That's for the Campaign Finance Board, the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, and the Administrative Hearings Office. And then I'll just move down to minute services. On the House side, the House bill did fund the request for the Blue Ribbon Council recommendations at $4.1 million, and then the requested operating adjustment of $229 million. This is all in fiscal year 22-23. The House bill also picked up the cancellation of $379,000. That was also a governor's position.
And in the Senate position, the Blue Ribbon Council recommendations were funded using a previous rider that exists in the minute base for cybersecurity enhancements. That's a $5 million annual base appropriation, and the Blue Ribbon Council recommendations are required to be carved from that, that appropriation. As with the House, the Senate also cancels the administrative holdbacks that were identified by the Commissioner of MMB and the Governor in October of 2020, and then it carries forward that operating reduction into the current, or into the budget biennium, and then eventually into the tails as well. Moving to administration, the Senate position funds the in lieu of rent increase requested by the governor. As with minute services, the administrative holdback is canceled in fiscal 21 and carried through into the budget biennium. There is $20,000 one time for flags and flagpoles for SHPO related to some changes that are made to the responsibilities of that office in Article 2. There is also $5.5 million in fiscal 21 and then $56,000 in fiscal 22 one time relating to the sale of the cold storage building at 1415 Laurient Street. The reason it's structured this way is the FEMA is required to be reimbursed for the sale of that building within a certain amount of time. There's also a statutory appropriation that exists for costs related to selling a building that are paid from the fund to which those funds will ultimately be deposited. That's the $56,000 in the year the building is presumed sold. There's also $174,000 one time to repair and reinstall the statue of Christopher Columbus on the Capitol complex.
And moving over to the House side, the House also funds the in lieu of rent increase. The House also picked up the cancellation of the administrative holdbacks of $300,000 in fiscal year 21, but then funded the recommended increase for the operating adjustments of $896,000. In fiscal year 21, there's $4.5 million for the enterprise planning space consolidation and relocation study. And then two other governor's initiatives, the improving equity in grants management and further advancing equity in procurement. Those two are also funded in the House bill. And finally, there is one member initiative, an AMPRS grant increase, and that is in the second year, fiscal year 23 of $125,000, and that would carry forward into the base. Moving down to Minnesota management and budget, on the House position, again, you'll see the fiscal year 21 cancellation of the administrative holdback, and then the increases for the operating adjustments going into fiscal year 22 and 23. Both the House and Senate have provided additional funding through an open appropriation to MMB related to the transfer of the single audit responsibilities from the legislative auditor to MMB. And then there's some special revenue expenses related to a governor's initiative for the Payment Plus program.
On the Senate side, the Senate bill makes the cancellation of the administrative holdback in fiscal 21 and again carries that that funding level into the current biennium. And then there's also a rider that requires MMB to reduce its complement of executive budget officer staff by six FTEs. As Ms. Roberts pointed out, there's also an open appropriation created for the single audit responsibilities as those are shifted from the legislative auditor to MMB. I think it's also worth noting that the governor's position decreased the OLA's funding to correspond to the amount that is being picked up at MMB. The Senate position does not make that corresponding reduction in the legislature. The Senate also has the funding for the Payment Plus program initiative put forward by the governor. And there is also here reflected the statutory reduction from local impact notes, that transfer that's going to the LBO instead of to MMB. At the Department of Revenue, the Senate position again makes a cancellation of an administrative holdback identified by the governor in fiscal 21 and carries that funding into the current budget biennium. And there is no change in the rider for volunteer income tax assistance, though there is I'll let Ms. Roberts talk a little bit more about the change in the rider, but it's a rider that is also, a statutory change that is carried in the Senate tax bill.
And moving over to the House position for Department of Revenue, again, you'll see that the House picked up the cancellation in fiscal year 21 for the administrative holdback and then funded the governor's recommendation for an operating adjustment, although this is at a lower level than the governor had requested. The House bill also provides additional funding for the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance or VITA grants, and as Mr. Erickson noted, there's language in Article 2, the policy language, related to this that expands that eligibility. So Mr. Gehring will touch on that. Then I'm going to move down real quickly. Most of the next agencies are all small agencies where the House funded the requested operating adjustment and the Senate provides base level funding. So I won't walk through all of them, but you can see it includes the ethnic councils. And then it would, moving down, one place we probably should stop is on the Historical Society. The House funded the operating adjustment. I will let Mr. Erickson talk about the Farm America grant, but I did want to note that the House does have a rider that is not directly related to a money issue, but is related to, it's a rider that's.
Ms. Roberts, I think you're muted.
Sorry about that. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. There's a rider under the Historical Society that provides that the Historical Society cannot charge for tours at the Capitol, and I apologize for that.
And then the only change in the Senate side is a one-time grant to Farm America. This was a Senator Weber bill. At the Arts Board, the Senate position makes a cancellation that had been identified in the governor's budget. This is $86,000 that is left over from a 2019 appropriation to the Arts Board for their moving and relocation expenses.
And on the House side, the House funding includes the requested operating adjustment. And I would also, here's another place where there are two riders that are not directly related to implementing funding. On the House side, first, there is one. The first rider says that money may only be spent for grant distributed as grants may only be spent on projects located in Minnesota. This is a rider that has been included in the state government bill before. And then there's an additional rider that says money appropriated and distributed as grants may not be used for projects that promote domestic terrorism or criminal activities. And that was a House floor amendment. Moving down to finish out this page, you'll see for the occupational licensing boards, again, the difference here is that the House funded the operating adjustment and the Senate is at the base level funding.
That will take us to the Public Employees Retirement Association, where the Senate position makes a reduction in the amount of state aid that is contributed to the Minneapolis Employees Retirement Fund. The overall funding for that plan is kept at $37 million. However, the split between the employers and the state is rebalanced so that the state's contribution is $20 million lower and the employers is $20 million higher. This is a statutory change that is in Article 2, and Ms. James can describe that a little bit more when that article is walked through. Then at the Gambling Control Board, the Senate position fully funds the original request from the governor as well as the revised recommendation from the governor for increased staffing and then for some one-time costs for creating and maintaining an information system.
And the House also funds the Gambling Control Board request. And there is a slight difference in the funding in the tails that is related to the riders that the House did not include. But if we want to implement the governor's request, we want to look at the Senate riders. Moving down, there's in the House bill, there's $500,000 in one-time funding to the Minnesota Council on Disability, and this is for sensory accessibility grants.
And then in the Senate bill, the governor's position on the Department of Military Affairs is funded at $588,000.
And on the House side, the governor's request of $588,000 is also funded. I'll move down to Veterans Affairs for the House bill. The funding is full funding of the governor's request for the operating adjustment of $8.2 million. There's funding provided for the Veterans Suicide Initiative of $1.65 million, $6 million for preventing and ending veterans homelessness, $400,000 for the 9/11 task force. And then the last three items are member initiatives. $294,000 was added to increase the Veterans Service Organization's funding, so that would bring them to $500,000 per year. And then the second one is $50,000 for the Veterans Resilience Project. And finally, on the House side, you'll see in brackets funding for the Veterans Camps and Retreats. It's in brackets because this was added as an amendment and no addition in committee with no additional funding designated. So it would have to come out of the department's programs and services funding. And then finally, there is from the Special Revenue Fund, the House bill has language changing the personal needs allowance at the domiciliaries to match the Department of Human Services provision or allowance for general assistance. So this would increase that personal needs allowance and then also allow it to adjust in the future. And that again is from the Special Revenue Fund.
On the Senate position, there is an increase for an operating adjustment at the Department of Veterans Affairs of $4 million as compared to the House's $8.2 million. The Veterans Suicide Initiative is funded at the levels requested by the governor. The governor's change item to prevent and end veterans homelessness is funded at $1.5 million, and the 9/11 task force at $112,000. And then there was also $150,000 included for the Camp Bliss grant that was carried by Senator Eichhorn. Moving down into, you'll see some totals here, but I'll pass over those for now and identify on line 184, there's a change in the Senate bill. It's an uncodified piece that says that if there are unfilled FTEs in the state after 180 days, the savings from those positions is captured and returned to the general fund. That anticipates about $274,000 each year in the budget biennium in saved expenditures. There was added in the Finance Committee a transfer to a stadium payoff fund that takes some money out of the stadium reserve, which is currently in the general fund, and puts it into a new fund to enable the refinancing of the stadium bonds when they become callable. You'll see here that that amounts to about a $156.7 million transfer in the budget biennium and is from the general fund to the stadium payoff fund.
And moving over to the House side, you'll see here the total of $22.55 million that is from the cancellation of the various carry-forward accounts for the legislature. And then moving down, additional change in revenues, the House bill has the governor's recommendation for a two-year reprieve in transfers from the state parking fund to the general fund. There is a projected shortfall in that fund because of people working from home and either not canceling their parking contracts or not using meters. So there's greatly reduced revenue in that fund.
On line 190, you will see that the Senate position reflects the anticipated sale of the cold storage building at 1415 Laurient Street. This is a $5.5 million anticipated revenue in fiscal 22. And then on line 192, you'll see another component of the Payment Plus program. This is the program where vendors can choose to get their rebates electronically for a small fee, which is deposited mostly in the general fund. That's the component that you'll see on this line, but a small amount is held back for MMB in the Special Revenue Fund to administer the program. You'll see the House also carries that on the right side. Both positions also reflect cancellations in the ITA account, the Information and Telecommunications account. These are for IT projects that have already been completed, and these are leftover funds. And of course, the ITA account is the account where agencies can put funds that would otherwise cancel to save up and implement certain IT projects. Then on line 198, you'll see the corresponding transfer in for the stadium payoff fund that I described above and the corresponding transfer into the special revenue fund for MMB that I described above. On lines 202 and 203, you'll see the non-general fund cancellations for projects that have been completed in the ITA account.
And then on line 200 on the House side, again, you'll see the change related to the personal needs allowance adjustment in the Department of Veterans Affairs special revenue account. And then I have to apologize to Mr. Erickson since I put this part of the spreadsheet together that I, in this total for non-general fund revenues, I kind of missed the biggest piece of all, which is the stadium payoff fund. So this total is incorrect. And then I can continue down at the bottom of the spreadsheet here where you'll see the general fund reconciliation for the bill. You can see the total spending for the House bill is $1.2 billion. Then there are revenue changes, and these are, again, related primarily to the cancellation of the carry-forward accounts of $22.6 million. So the net spending is $1.218 billion. And then there's an offset, or we bring in the change from fiscal year 21, which is a negative 5.1 million. And then the total net change is 1.214 billion on the House side.
And you'll be able to see those same numbers and calculations on the Senate side, yielding a $1.311 billion total net general fund spend for the fiscal 21 plus the budget biennium on the Senate side. And Ms. Roberts, I think I may have stepped on part of your presentation earlier. Did I give you a chance to describe the Veterans Affairs riders before I skipped into the revenues? I may have interrupted.
Sorry, we can... Or I forgot to mention them. There are some riders on the in the House bill that were included in the previous state government bill 2 years ago, and so the House bill does pick these up. They are related to under veterans health care. These are in the side by side, requiring a report on the special revenue fund at the veterans homes, looking at the reserve amounts and expenditures from that fund. And then there is also a rider related to maximizing federal reimbursement. So members may want to take a look at that language on the side by side.
And then
go ahead.
Okay. And then I was just going to say, and then it, finally, I think at the very end of the side by side for Article 1, there are two uncodified sections that are carried in the House side for which there's no Senate comparison. One is the cancellation of $5 million of the Senate carry forward, which is moot because of the repeal of the legislative carry forward entirely later in the bill. Maybe Ms. Roberts can speak to the second.
The second provision was a House floor amendment related to federal funds replacement. And it says that the Commissioner of Management and Budget must determine whether expenditures under the this bill are eligible uses of federal funding received under the coronavirus federal acts. And if so, then if they determine those, any of these expenditures are eligible, the federal funds must be used and the corresponding general fund money would be deposited back in the general fund.
And Mr. Chair, I think that brings us to the end of our presentation, unless folks have questions or you intend to move to the next article.
And I will stop sharing the screen now.
Members, are there any questions of this portion? See no hands jumping up there. Thank you, Ms. Roberts. Thank you, Mr. Erickson. The next we'll move on to the election policy with Mr. Gehring and Ms. Stangle. I introduce yourselves and you can proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, I'm Matt Gehring from the Nonpartisan House Research Department.
Mr. Chair, I'm Lexi Stangle with Senate Counsel.
And Mr. Chair, the way we're going to go through this, I've shared the screen to show the comparison policy summary for all of you. This is not the revised side-by-side, but this is the document that Ms. Stangle and I prepared. That's how we'll do the walkthrough of the rest of the articles of the bill, just to kind of keep things high level. But we're happy to dig into the actual side-by-side if you'd like, if members have specific questions. So the order that we're going to do things this morning is going to be the Elections Administration article, then campaign finance, and then following that, we'll do the state government policy article and the IT article, and then veterans and military affairs, and then local government at the very end. And we'll be bouncing back and forth between different staff, depending on who is responsible for those articles. So I'll sort of cue you up to who's speaking next, if that's helpful to all of you. So we'll start first, like I said, with the Elections Administration Policy article. The first section that you see there is a House-only section that provides a permanent statutory appropriation of money from the Help America Vote Act account. So this would provide money to the Secretary of State's office from the HAVA account as it becomes available. Current law requires the legislature to act to actually appropriate the money to the secretary, and this instead would provide it directly as it's appropriated by Congress.
The next sections to talk about are two Senate-only sections, and these have to do with ballot question advocacy. The two sections prohibit the Secretary of State and public officials as defined in Chapter 10A from spending public funds for the purpose of promoting or defeating a ballot question.
And then next, Mr. Chair, you'll see several places throughout these summaries, you'll see sort of big chunks of sections and line references where we've sort of consolidated smaller pieces or pieces of policy that sort of span many pages or sections into a single line just for ease of reading. The first one here is what I would call miscellaneous election administration changes that are House only changes. These are all changes that come from the Secretary of State's agency bill. They include things such as extending the time during which absentee ballots can be opened and counted, changes in terminology related to a person's residence for purposes of voting, eliminating the three-person limit on the number of individuals of voter number of voters an individual can assist on election day. Then also there's an extension of the availability of some previously appropriated Help America Vote Act account funds. And then moving on page R2 of the side-by-side, you'll see the first three sections that come from Representative Greenman's bill that relate to voter intimidation. So there's substantive policy changes later in the side-by-side, but the first section you see is on page R2 that gives the Attorney General authority to enforce some of these new remedies. So there's civil and criminal remedies related to voter intimidation, interference and deceptive practices in elections. And so there's a, and I said that that comes from Representative Greenman's bill, and the first section related to that is on page R2. Next is also a House-only provision providing for automatic voter registration. That starts on page R3 of the side-by-side. Also on page R3, House Section 5 is a House-only provision that requires post-secondary institutions that enroll students that accept state financial aid to prepare a residential housing list of students either who live on campus or within 10 miles of campus. Currently, that's a permissive authority in the law, and this would make it mandatory. Again, that's a House-only provision. Following that is a series of sections that restore voting rights to individuals who have been convicted of a felony. So under current law, as you all probably know, voting rights are restored after a person's sentence is fully discharged. This language would instead restore voting rights upon release from incarceration for that conviction if incarceration is imposed.
And Mr. Chair, next, there are some Senate-only provisions. The first group, you'll see there are multiple sections here, the first starting on R3 and scattered throughout the rest of the bill. The first set of sections I'll talk about has to do with election day registration and provisional ballots. These sections modify election day registration procedures so that a person that shows up at the polling place, instead of going through the current process, they will instead complete a voter registration application and then cast a provisional ballot. Within the week after the election day, all of those voter registration applications are then processed. And if the person is determined to be registered to vote, then their provisional ballot is accepted. The person doesn't need to return to the city or county office after the election to prove anything for this. It's all done sort of administratively. The next set of sections has to do with challenged voters. And those are individuals whose voter registration status is challenged either in the SVRS or on election day. And it requires all voters whose registration status is challenged to cast a challenged ballot. And there are some modifications also made throughout the bill for notification when a challenge or when a status is changed in the SVRS, the voter is mailed a notice of that change. If the change is to include a challenge, there's a process by which you can contest that challenge with the agency that provided that information. And this process takes place outside of the polling place. This is a year-long process. It doesn't tie just to election day. And the challenging process, the process to challenge a voter in the election, on election day in the polling place is also modified. There are two types of challenged ballots, one of which is sort of processed administratively afterwards based on state data, and the person does not need to return to prove eligibility in those situations. There's a second type of challenge ballot called a verification challenge ballot, and those are the challenges that are not based on state data, and in those situations, the voter does need to return to the city or county office to prove eligibility within a week after the election. The determination of the type of ballot depends on the type of challenge and the basis of that challenge. Next, there are a group of similar, what we've been calling miscellaneous election provisions. Many of these are also from the Secretary of State bill. And these include changes to the several timelines, like the post-election sampling timeline, some changes to polling place designations, amending thresholds for the post-election review, some technical changes to properly name absentee envelope types. We're looking to make sure addresses match on absentee envelopes when the ballot board reviews them. Some provisions relating to having your ballots counted when you're filing jointly. Counting ballots that are prepackaged at the end of election day. And various other timelines. And then there are a few clarifications in the presidential nomination primary sections. And there are also a few minor and technical differences in these sections. And then we hit a series on the top of the next page. And these are, as you can see, several sections that are the same between the House and Senate. And again, many of these are from the Secretary of State bill and contain a variety of subjects, including changes to who may use the absentee voting procedures, making changes to vote absentee voter lists being made public, clarifying timelines, specifying ballot formatting, requiring certain notices to go to the Secretary of State's office, talking about not having special elections within 4 days of a holiday, some additional presidential nomination primary cleanups, and then other minor and technical changes.
And then next, Mr. Chair, is a House-only set of sections that comes from Representative Long's bill. This is language that authorizes major political parties to use the errors and omissions process to protect against improper use of their party name by a candidate on the ballot. That sort of intellectual property protection is already provided in current law, and this provides a procedure for a party to enforce that authority. Next is a floor amendment that was adopted that was offered by Representative New Brindley that prohibits certain types of compensation structures for individuals who collect absentee ballots. So they would be prohibited from being paid based on the number of absentee ballot applications that they collect. Next, page R25 of the side-by-sides, this House Section 29 is language that Representative Jay Jong proposed that requires the Secretary of State to prepare translated voting instructions for in-person absentee voters. The languages that are required the required languages are Spanish, Hmong, and Somali. And then last on this page, you'll see a section that allows candidates to request that their residential home address be maintained as confidential when they file for office if they have a reasonable fear for their safety. Next, on page R33 of the side-by-side, it's this House Section 42, and Senate has a couple of different sections. There are some policy differences here in the section of the section of the bill that regulates how polling places are designated. So on the House side, what happens here, this comes from the Secretary of State's administrative bill. There's language that only requires local governments to adopt an ordinance or resolution designating polling places for each precinct if they're actually changing a polling place, as opposed to requiring a new resolution or ordinance every year to reestablish the same polling places and precincts. And I'll have Ms. Dangle describe the Senate changes.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Mr. Chair, the Senate provisions take a different approach, and they leave in place the current process for designating polling places every year by resolution, but instead make some modifications that relate to redistricting. Under current law, you have to designate your polling places by the end of the calendar year. And with redistricting taking place at the beginning of a new calendar year, this allows local governments to redesignate sort of outside of that regular timeline once redistricting is completed.
And then next, Mr. Chair, you'll see a House-only section. This is House Sections 43 and 44, language that was proposed by Representative Cleborne that authorizes school boards to grant academic credit to high school students who are agreed to serve as trainee student election judges. Then also requires election judge appointing authorities to recruit bilingual high school students to serve in that capacity when possible. And Ms. Roberts mentioned the appropriation that goes along with this language in her walkthrough of Article 1.
Mr. Chair and members, the next are some Senate-only sections, again, grouped under the heading of Miscellaneous Election Administration. And here there are five sections. The first requires a list of election judges and their party affiliations to be collected and shared with the respective chairs of the state party. The second requires the election judge at a polling place to provide a copy of the summary statement or the tape to candidates upon request. The third requires all election equipment to have audit logs, which are a piece of technology on the equipment that sort of tracks everything that goes on with that particular machine. And then those audit logs are collected and forwarded to the Secretary of State and provided to the legislature, as well as being maintained by the local governments as part of their election materials for the statutory period. And then finally, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is required to either conduct themselves or to contract with somebody to audit election equipment. And there are a series of things that must be examined relating to the procurement, the software, and the hardware used on those pieces of equipment. And the next line is a Senate-only provision, and this prohibits political subdivisions from adopting or using ranked choice voting for local offices.
And then, Mr. Chair, the final line on this page, you see House Section 76. This is language that authorizes the Secretary of State to use Help America Vote Act account funds and distribute them as grants of political subdivisions for purposes that are authorized under the federal HAVA law. These are things related to election security and other sort of administrative parts of election process that are handled by local governments. So that's what this section would do, is allow them the money to go to local governments for that purpose.
The next two sections on page R64 are Senate-only provisions, and these two sections modify how presidential electors are selected. Instead of the current winner-take-all presidential elector system, the eight of the state's presidential electors would be selected based on the total, the vote totals of each congressional district, and then the two at-large presidential electors would be on the statewide vote total.
And then lastly, Mr. Chair, in the elections article is a House-only section, House Section 93, that directs the Secretary of State to adopt an administrative rule that recognizes a medical bill as a proof of residence for purposes of Election Day registration. And as you know, most of the sort of commonly thought of documents that can be used for Election Day registration are in current administrative rules, so this would just require the addition of this medical bill to that list. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the policy article for Elections Administration. So next, we're going to move on to campaign finance.
And Mr. Gehring, let's just check here to make sure. Is there anybody in the committee have any questions about the of what we've gone through on this section of the elections? If you want to unshare the screen, Mr. Gehring, and I can see if anyone's got their hand up. Thank you. Seeing no hands jumping up, proceed with the rest of the with the next section, Mr. Gehring.
Okay, Mr. Chair, so then the next policy article of the bill that we'll compare between Ms. Stengel and I is the campaign finance article. This is House Article 4 and Senate Article 3. And the first sort of clump of policy changes that I'll point out here is language that comes from Representative Freiberg's bill. It's House-only language that transfers the oversight of certain types of campaign finance reporting and disclosure from requiring. So under current law, certain candidates are required to file their campaign finance reports with Hennepin County. Instead, this would transfer that obligation to the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. So the board itself would have more oversight of Hennepin County candidates. This includes both Hennepin County and cities located within Hennepin County that have a population of 75,000 people or more, as well as the Minneapolis School District. Next is a House-only section that expands the definition of expressly advocating. This comes from Representative Greenman's bill. So included in the definition of expressly advocating under this language would be communications that are susceptible to no reasonable interpretation except as campaign communications, even if they don't use or sort of commonly understood to be the magic words such as vote for or vote against. And the definition of expressly advocating is used for determining whether an independent expenditure is required to be disclosed in a public report to the Campaign Finance Board. The section also includes some conforming changes that goes along with the Hennepin County changes I just mentioned above. And then next is a section that there's some similar language between the House and the Senate. On the House side, this comes from Representative Lucero's proposal. This is House Section 10 that authorizes a candidate to make expenditures for certain security-related expenses and report them as a non-campaign disbursement when they use campaign funds to do that. There's a $2,000 cap on the House side for how much may be spent and reported under this category. And there's also a definition of immediate family member that can be used. So if a candidate is purchasing security equipment for either themselves or for an immediate family member that fits the definition here of security expenses, that could be reported as a non-campaign disbursement. And Ms. Engel can describe the Senate side. And Ms. Engel, I think you're muted.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Mr. Chair and members, the Senate has similar language, so I'll just point out the differences. The Senate includes a $3,000 cap as opposed to the $2,000 cap in the House language. And the way that the qualifying expenses are talked about are a little bit different. They're the same sort of concept of security things, security items, but talked about in a little bit different way. And the Senate does not include the authority for immediate family members. It's just for the candidate themselves. And finally, the Senate includes an effective date that applies to expenses or payments made going back to January 1st of this year. And then there are some additional sections that are the same. These come from the Campaign Finance Board bill. The next set of section, the next section on R6, House 13 and Senate 2, add the chancellor and members and boards of MNSCU to the definition of public official under Chapter 10A, which would pull them into some of the requirements and filings under that chapter. The next set of sections are on R7 to R10, and these are also same provisions between the House and the Senate, again from the Campaign Finance Board bill. And these modify and reorganize the requirements related to filing statements of economic interest. Then on R12, there's a Senate-only section, and this authorizes a candidate, a treasurer, or several other types of people to provide alternate contact information to the board that the board may use to contact these people for purposes of the board. The idea being that the forms that are filed with the board are public information, and sometimes people will use their campaign contact information or something like that because that's what's publicly available. But in theory, it would actually be easier to provide their private or personal information. It would be easier for the board to reach them at that contact information, but they don't want it public. So this allows sort of a two-tier system where there's still public contact info, but also private contact info that just the board has access to. Then there are several same provisions, again, coming from the Campaign Finance Board bill. And these are just sort of a mishmash of items relating to filing of campaign reports, standards for certain disclosures by unregistered associations, talking about what types of messages, like text messages, are not considered contributions to a candidate when there's multiple candidates on that text message, and when that's coordinated by a party unit. And then there's another Senate-only provision. This is on R18, Senate Section 12. And this has to do with the public subsidy. So essentially what it does is redistribute the public subsidy amounts that would have been paid to a candidate for an office. Let me start over. I was going down a confusing road. So essentially when a candidate's opponent is not eligible for the public subsidy, that amount that they would have received is redistributed to that person's opponent.
And then, Mr. Chair, next is a series of House-only sections that will close out this article. The first is a requirement that disclaimers for independent expenditures include the top three contributors responsible for funding the expenditure. And there's detail that you can see in the side-by-side for determining who the top three contributors to the expenditure actually are. And then next, there's a House-only section that sort of reorganizes and requires the Campaign Finance Board to take some action to specify how disclaimers would be provided on certain types of small electronic communications, so text messages and the like. The board is required to do some work this interim to figure out what those, how those disclaimers would look and how they could practically be shared on these small types of advertisements where you can't conveniently put a full disclaimer. And then last is a House-only section that provides that the article is effective January 1 of 2022. In this section, it's a little bit misleading the way that the side-by-side is set up, but this effective date was intended to attach to the Hennepin County transfer language that I talked about. That's the first row on our list here. But as it sort of appears in the side-by-side, it applies to everything else on the House side. So if you end up choosing to adopt any of these sections, we'll make sure that the effective date is reflected correctly. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the campaign finance article. And we're happy to take questions if you have them. We may have lost Chair Nelson, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, I guess sorry about that. I was muted. I see no hands jumping up. So members, if not, any questions on this section? Mr. Gehring and Ms. Fengel, proceed with the next section.
Okay, and then Mr. Chair, the next section that we're going to walk through is the state government general policy article. So my partner in Senate counsel for this section is going to be Stephanie James. And Ms. Roberts and Mr. Erickson already walked through the appropriations article as well as the funding items that were shown in Article 1. So we're going to skip ahead in the summary to go specifically to the policy sections. The first section in the policy article is a House-only section that designates the Bill and Bonnie Daniels Firefighter Hall and Museum as the official state fire museum. This is a proposal from Representative Sydney Jordan. And then the next set of sections that you see there, starting on page R8-A2 of the side-by-side, are some conforming changes that reflect the new statutory appropriation structure that the House proposes for the legislative budget. Ms. Roberts described the change in the way that the legislature will be funded earlier in her walkthrough of Article 1. So these are the policy changes that go with that to actually make the appropriations.
Mr. Chair and members, Stephanie James from Senate Counsel. The next item is some changes to the Legislative Advisory Commission and the way that it approves federal funds. Section 1 on the Senate side expands the membership of the Legislative Advisory Commission, and then sections 2-6 on the Senate side modify the process for the LAC to approve the expenditure of federal funds. The next item is the same in both bills regarding the Legislative Reference Library. It authorizes the Legislative Reference Library to receive copies of state documents at no cost. And then the bottom item on the page, also the same in both bills, provides a technical update to clarify the LCC's authority to coordinate the activities of the joint commissions. And the top item on the next page is a Senate-only provision. This authorizes the Legislative Budget Office to prepare fiscal notes when agencies do not do so. It also provides certain access to data and employees so that the LBO can prepare fiscal notes. The second item, the second row there, similar between the two bills. These are all provisions that were in the legislative auditor's bill. They provide a number of administrative and technical updates, but I will point out that the Senate has a couple provisions that the House does not. Section 12 on the Senate side precludes an employee of the legislative auditor from running for an elected public office, and the House does not include that provision. And then also one sentence in Section 16 on the Senate side creates a statutory appropriation to the legislative auditor of money in the data security count, and the House does not include that. And then the next item is a Senate-only provision. Senate Section 20 requires agencies to report to the legislature on federal funds that they received that allowed them to reduce the use of state funds.
And then, Mr. Chair, the next couple of sections are House-only sections. The first one is a repeal. This is policy language that goes with a repeal that you'll see at the end of the side-by-side. The repeal is the requirement for a Minnesota milestones report. This milestones report is hasn't been produced since 2011 and is a program that sort of uses sort of livability measures and kind of performance outcomes to determine productivity in Minnesota state laws. The next line there you'll see is some language that relates to the state demographer as well as the Met Council, and this is language that delays the required submission of population estimates to local governments that reflects the delay in the availability of census data this decade. And then the last row on this page you'll see is the language that relates to the public display of business addresses. This is policy language that authorizes small businesses that have one owner or are very small that use their residential address as their business address to require to request that their address not be publicly displayed on the Secretary of State's business registration's website. The policy concepts between the House and the Senate are largely the same. There are some stylistic and technical drafting differences between between the two. And then the next row that you see at the top of the following page of the summary designates August 15th of each year as India Day. And again, the concept between the House and the Senate is identical, but there are some stylistic drafting differences between the two. And then House Section 17 is a House-only section that comes next. This is a language that was offered by Representative Beckerfin that requires, it codifies an executive order that's been in existence for a number of years that requires state agencies to engage and be guided by a meaningful and timely consultation process with tribal governments on relevant aspects of their agency's work. And there's a number of details about how that process would work in the House language.
The next item is a Senate-only provision. Senate Section 23 requires legislative approval to extend a peacetime emergency beyond 30 days. That's the governor's declaration of a peacetime emergency. The next item, Section 24 on the Senate side, clarifies the data status of unofficial fiscal notes. And the next item, Senate Section 26, requires an agency to have specific authority to adopt rules. The next item, Senate Section 27, lowers the threshold for the number of people that are required to request a hearing on rulemaking that is noticed as dual track. Right now, the threshold is 100 people, and this lowers it to 25 people. The next item on Senate Section 28 and 109 makes the decision of an administrative law judge in a contested case proceeding the final decision. Currently, under current law, that the decision of the ALJ is advisory to the agency. The next item, Senate Sections 31 and 35, reestablishes the SAVI initiative, the State Agency Value Initiative. This is something that allows an agency to keep from one biennium to the next money that they've saved through achieving certain efficiencies. And then there's a process for approval for them to spend that money in the next biennium. The next item is Senate Section 32, and this limits the growth in state employment based on the population of the state. And then the bottom item on this page is Senate Section 33 and House Section 18. These are similar, but for technical drafting differences. This requires Minnesota Management and Budget to contract with a qualified auditor to perform the single audit, the audit of federal funds that Mr. Erickson had spoken about earlier.
And then next, Mr. Chair, is a House-only section. This is House Section 19 that changes the required date of the state's November budget forecast so that it must be released by December 6th of each year as opposed to during the first week of December. And then next is similar language between the House and Senate. This is House Section 20 and Senate Section 34 that eliminates some obsolete language regarding the way that surplus budget balances are transferred to the Clean Water Fund at the end of a biennium. The language is similar only because there was one additional conforming reference that the Senate didn't pick up on their side of things, but otherwise the outcome is the same. House Section 21 and Senate Section 36 authorizes the Commissioner of Management and Budget to establish a virtual payments program. So when vendors are entitled to payment from the state, the MMB would be able to submit an electronic payment to them as opposed to a traditional paper check type of payment.
And the next item is a Senate-only item, Senate Sections 37, 88 through 90, and 105. These provide for establishing, Mr. Erickson mentioned this, a separate fund that could be used to pay off the stadium bonds early. And there's calculations for determining how much would go into that fund each year. And then the next item is the same in both bills, modifying the list of buildings for which the Department of Administration is responsible. And the bottom item on this page, similar between the two bills, House Section 23, Senate Section 39, requires the Commissioner of Administration to collect payment for use of electric charging stations on the Capitol grounds. The Senate includes an additional sentence that requires that the amount charged be set so that it covers the cost of the electricity, depreciation on the machines, and other administrative expenses for providing those charging stations. And the next item is...
Sorry. Lost their page. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the next item is a House only. Are we on the Capital Flag program?
That's right.
Okay. These are similar between the two bills. Section 24 in the House bill, Section 3 of Article 5 in the Senate bill. It establishes a program that provides U.S. and Minnesota flags that have been flown at the Capitol to the families of public safety officers who were killed in the line of duty. The House also includes an allowance to use this for flags flown for fallen police canine officers, and the Senate does not include that provision. The next item, Senate Historic Sites, or State Historic Sites, is a Senate-only provision. Sections 40, 41, 66, 68, 69, and 74, these all add responsibility for the State Historic Preservation Office to have more of a role in management of historic sites, shifting responsibilities in most cases away from the Historical Society. And the next item, similar between the two bills, State Service Canines, Section 25 on the House side, Section 42 on the Senate side. It allows the Commissioner of Administration to transfer title to canine service dogs to their handlers. The Senate has added some language that makes it clear that we're talking about retired canines.
Then, Mr. Chair, next are a couple of House-only sections. House Section 26. Reorganizes and recodifies language that establishes the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Resolution. So that it's housed within the Department of Administration. And then the next section, House Section 27, codifies the Office of Enterprise Sustainability, which is also an office within the Department of Administration that exists currently by executive order. And both of these sections come from the department's administrative bill. And then next is some identical language between the House and the Senate. This is House Section 28 and Senate Section 43, also from the Department of Administration's administrative and technical bill that eliminates some obsolete duties and requirements that relate to the department's work. Also identical is language related to the department's management of the state's motor pool and fleet services. This changes terminology related to the way that program is described, and it's identical between the House and the Senate. House Section 31 is a House-only section that provides statutory authorization for state agencies to retain a portion of appropriations that are made to an agency for grant administration so that the agency administering the grant can retain certain percentages of those appropriations for administrative costs of actually administering the grant. And that the percentage depends on the type of grant that's being administered. House Section 32 is a House-only section. This was a floor amendment offered by Representative New Brindley that prohibits state agencies from entering a contract with a vendor that produces and manufactures or procures goods from certain regions in China. And then House Section 33 and Senate Section 30 similar language between the House and the Senate that requires agencies to balance any necessary layoffs of state employees to ensure that the economies of the state outside of the metropolitan area are not disproportionately affected. There are some drafting differences, including in the way that those sections are coded between the House and the Senate, but the concept is largely the same. Then House Section 34 is a House-only section. This is Representative Carlson's bill that shifts the Commissioner of Management Budget's duty to provide an option for a high deductible health plan for certain employee groups so that it's a permissive authority rather than a mandatory one. And then House Sections 35 and Senate Section 59 are similar. This is language that requires the Commissioner of Management and Budget to contract for a pharmacy benefit manager to assist with the state employee group insurance program. Effective January 1, 2023. There is a couple of sort of technical drafting differences between the House and the Senate language here, as well as the addition of an amendment that was adopted in the House committee that requires designees from the Joint Labor Management Committees to assist with the reverse auction process, and that's the process that will be used to select the pharmacy benefit manager under this language. And then next, there's more language that comes from the Department of Administration's technical and administrative bill that changes the way that historic sites are managed and operated. And this relates to the way that the State Historic Preservation Office was transferred from the Historical Society to the Department of Administration several years ago. It's identical between the two bodies for purposes of that concept. There's some other changes and policy concepts that the Senate picked up that the House does not, that I'll have Ms. James walk through in the next line.
Yes, in the next line, on the House side, Section 38, and on the Senate side, 63, one of the changes that were in the bill as originally prepared or requested by the Department of Administration was that the Historical Society be designated as the agency for purposes of the Federal Act for preserving historical and archaeological data. So the House has included that modification to current law. The Senate did not take that change to current law. And then the rest of the provision makes other technical changes, and the Senate does include those other technical changes. And then the next item, House Section 42 and Senate Section 70. Under current law, there's a preclusion on an employee of the Historical Society serving on the mediation task force. And these task force is something that is convened when there's a difference of opinion between an agency and the Historical Society about how the Historic Preservation Office about how a project to renovate a building should go. That's when the task force is convened. And under current law, an employee of the Historical Society is not allowed to serve on that task force. The House's bill, Section 42, is eliminating that preclusion on an employee serving. And then the Senate, for one thing, does not get rid of that preclusion, so the preclusion stays, and then also adds a requirement that an agency consult with SHPO before conveying state-owned property. I think those are the major changes in that section. The next item is a Senate-only provision, Senate Section 73. This requires the State Historic Preservation Office to fly U.S. and Minnesota flags at historic sites owned by the state. I should mention, Section oh, I guess we've already covered it, that there are sections that shift responsibilities for managing the state historic sites from the Historical Society to the State Historic Preservation Office for sites that are owned by the state. The next item, the bottom line on the on this page, is Senate-only sections, a series of sections that eliminate the Board of Cosmetology and move responsibilities for regulating cosmetology to the Department of Health. It also eliminates a requirement that a school manager be a cosmetologist. And the next item at the top of the next page, in on the Senate side only, Senate Section 79 precludes public employers from contracting to pay more than is approved in a spending plan, which would reflect the amount appropriated to the agency. And the next series of sections, 81 through 87, are from the Racing Commission bill. They mostly provide a number of administrative and technical changes. It allows, under current law, a racetrack is required to have a certain number of racing days per year in order to maintain their license and to offer card playing at the racetrack. So this, there's an exception, however, that allows the Racing Commission to approve a lower number of racing days. So the change in the law here adds some specified circumstances when that kind of permission would be allowed, and then also requires permission of the Horsemen's Association to allow that accommodation.
Then the next section is House Section 46, and as we go through, I'm seeing all of my typos here, and this should be identified as the House-only section rather than blank. This section gives census workers access to residential apartment buildings, other multi-unit facilities for purposes of conducting the decennial census. This comes from the Department of Administration's technical bill. And then following that section, you'll see a set of three sections that are House-only sections for purposes of this bill, but two of those sections are included in the Senate's tax bill currently in that conference committee. These are the sections that Ms. Roberts mentioned in her walkthrough of Article 1 that provide a background check, These are the sections that provide for a background check procedure for individuals who have access to federal tax information to conform with federal law. The two substantive sections here are identical in the Senate tax bill, and there's one additional purpose statement section that the House picks up that's not included on the Senate side in the tax bill. The next section is the taxpayer assistance grants policy language that is House only. This is House Section 48. This is the one that Ms. Roberts mentioned when she was doing the walkthrough of Article 1 that expands eligibility so that more organizations beyond just nonprofits can participate in this program. So federal law authorizes certain government entities and others to receive grants. And so this picks up that change that's reflected here in this policy section, and it was also reflected in the House's rider in Article 1. Next, House Section 50 and Senate Section 91 are identical sections that permit members of the Gambling Control Board to remain in the position until a successor is appointed, unless the appointing authority directs differently.
The next item is Senate only, Sections 92 and 93, and these classify as private data the name of the winner of lottery prizes and second chance drawings through the lottery where the prize is more than $10,000. And the last item on this page, Senate only, Sections 94 and 95, is a shift of the contributions required to PARA, the Public Employee Retirement Plan, for MERF, the Minneapolis Employers Retirement Fund. It reduces the state contribution by $10 million and then increases the contribution required of the Minneapolis employers by $10 million. And the next item, also Senate only, Senate Section 96. Under current law, there's a transfer in statute of $207,000from that goes to the management and budget for the purpose of preparing local impact notes. But because that responsibility for preparing those has been moved to the Legislative Budget Office, this makes that transfer in statute send the money to the LBO instead of to MMB. And the next item, daylight savings time, Senate only Section 97 places the state on daylight saving time all year once federal law permits that change.
And then next, Mr. Chair, is going to be a series of House-only sections. House Section 53 is a section that establishes a working group to make recommendations for the creation of a racial equity impact note for proposed legislation. This is language that Representative Samantha Vang proposed. The report by this working group would be due February 1st of 2022, and the group would expire September 1 of 2023. And the proposed notes here would, the idea of this language is to recommend a process that would be similar to the fiscal note creation process, but instead being to study racial equity impacts on legislation. House only section 54 is policy language that goes with the appropriation Ms. Roberts mentioned earlier to the Department of Administration for sensory accessibility accommodations grants. These would be grants to support building modifications and other accommodations needs for individuals with autism spectrum disorder or other sensory disabilities. Then House Section 55 is a House-only section, an amendment offered by Representative Nash that authorizes individuals to purchase a raffle ticket by phone using a check or debit card when they make their purchase. And that authority would expire July 1st of 2022. And then House Section 56 and Senate Section 103, there are some policy differences between the two. The concept is sort of similar. On the House side, there's a requirement that the Commissioner of Administration submit a report to the legislature that describes a plan for future use of the property at 1415 Laurie Street or Laurie Avenue in St. Paul. This was property that was purchased about a year ago for potential needs related to the COVID-19 pandemic. And on the House side, the requirement instead is that the Commissioner of Administration designate that property as surplus and dispose of it using those procedures. Next, House Sections 57 to 59 are House-only sections that establish a mass demonstration response review commission. This is a commission that is would be appointed by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court and would be responsible for reviewing state and local officials' reactions and responses to the public mass demonstrations that Minnesota saw in 2020, as well as the demonstrations that we saw more recently this year. The report from that commission would be due by December 15th of 2021. And there is an appropriation for this commission to the legislative auditor as fiscal agent in Article 1 of the bill. The next House Section 61 is a repealer section. So there's a number of subdivisions within that section. One of the repealers is to repeal the employee gain sharing program. This is the program that exists in law that requires the Commissioner of Management and Budget to provide an incentive structure for state employees who make suggestions that lead to documented cost savings to state agency operations, and then to share a portion of that savings to the employee. This language proposes that program be repealed. And then next, also in that same House Section 61, the repealer section is the repeal of a statute that obligates certain agency heads to provide reports to the legislature when they're going to either transfer money within the agency or outside of the agency. The current requirement under that section is that those transfers be reported to the chairs and ranking minority members of the legislative committees with responsibility of state government. That's being proposed to be repealed here.
And the remaining sections in this article on this document are Senate provisions. If you're following along on the actual side-by-side, you'll need to go back to page R56. And Senate Section 98 requires that federal funds received during a period of time from March 1st, 2021 to June 30th, 2022 be spent only through a direct appropriation of law. And so those funds would not follow the typical LAC, Legislative Advisory Commission, process. The next item, Senate Section 99, precludes an agency from imposing a penalty for violation of the COVID executive orders that is beyond the penalty specified in the order. Senate Section 100 reduces appropriations to agencies for the biennium ending June 30th, 2023, by the amount of salaries and benefits for positions that go unfilled for 180 days after posting. And certain positions are exempted from that. The next item, Senate Section 101, requires each agency to list grants of rulemaking authority when it submits its obsolete rules report that would be due at the end of this year in December of 2021, and specifies the contents that that report will have to require. And then it makes a grant of rulemaking authority to be presumed invalid for adopting future rules if it's based on rulemaking authority that isn't cited in the report. And then the next section, Senate Section 104, requires the Commissioner of Administration to repair and replace the Columbus statue on the Capitol grounds. And the next item, Senate Section 107, requires the Commissioner of Administration to report to the legislature on contracts entered into under emergency powers. And the last item in Article 2, Senate Section 108, requests that the legislative auditor conduct a special review of the state's response to COVID-19. That's a request and not a requirement. And that is it for Article 2.
Members, any questions on Article 2 before we proceed? If not, proceed with the next section.
Then, Mr. Chair, the last article that Ms. James and I will walk through is the information technology article, and this one will probably be fairly quick. There's pretty similar language between the House and the Senate throughout this article. The first row you see on this page is the establishment of the Legislative Commission on Cybersecurity. This is a commission that's required to, that would be created to provide oversight of the state's cybersecurity measures and review policies and practices related to cyber threats and internet security. There's similar language between the House and the Senate. The Senate includes a mechanism to elect a chair if there's not a majority, and then also clarifies the way that the terms for first members would sort of get off the ground. But otherwise, the concepts between the two bills are the same. And then the next row you see here is reflects language on the House side that was Representative Bonner's bill that includes technical and some administrative updates to the structure of the Office of Minute Services. Much of this language comes from the Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission on IT. Now, there's also some language that comes in here from report that the legislative auditor did on IT services a couple of years ago. It's identified here as being identical between the House and the Senate. There are a couple of like really small commas and things that I noticed were different between the two just this morning, but the result is the same between the House and the Senate. There's a number of changes here that include renaming the legal name of the office from the Office of Minute Services to the Department of Information Technology Services. And as I said, there's other sort of policy recommendations and changes that come from the Blue Ribbon Commission and the OLA report and some other sort of administrative updates to the structure of that office's chapter of statute. And Ms. James, I don't know if I missed anything in there that you wanted to highlight.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gehring, and members, I would just note that the one of the changes in that second batch there is to make the an existing advisory council similar in makeup to the Blue Ribbon Council.
And Mr. Chair, that's the end of the IT article.
Unmute myself here. Any questions, members, on the IT article? Seeing no hands popping up, we can proceed to the next article. Which is that, Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, so the next article is going to be the Veterans and Military Affairs Policy article, and I'm going to share my screen to show the summary as I've been doing, and then Mr. Diebel is going to walk through the actual language there.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Diebel.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be again with the Veterans and Military Affairs Policy. The first article I'll be discussing has mostly identical or very similar language between the House and Senate. The first section in House Article 7 and Senate Article 5 relates to some minor changes to the Veterans Suicide Prevention and Awareness Day. It changes the title of the day and then directs the commissioner to implement activities to raise awareness of the day and the issue that it is intended to show public awareness for. Section 2 authorizes the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to hire a publicity representative. Section 3 relates to an agency bill from the Department of Military Affairs and how they go about appointing and replacing the Adjutant General of the National Guard. Moving on to Section 4, this is identical language in the House and Senate, and it relates to the Veterans Stable Housing Initiative, and it authorizes the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to establish that initiative and then provides guidance about how to go about that. Sections 5 and 8, and this covers H.R. 2 to R8 of the side-by-side, if you're looking at the language itself, relate to the Minnesota GI Bill. And this, again, is an agency proposal, and it's almost identical between the Senate and the House. There are some technical differences that Senate and House councils suggest that adopting this House version. Moving on to Section 9 relates to veterans supplemental programs. That's the title of the statute. It's amending it, and it contains two provisions. One, it allows the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs to provide dental services and work with providers for veterans. And the second provision relates to gives express authority for the commissioner to provide adult daycare services to veterans. They're doing that now, but this would give them formal authority to do so. Moving on to Section 10, this is one of the few House-only provisions in this article, and it relates to the cost of care and how the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs goes about calculating the personal needs allowance for domiciliary residents use the state's veterans domicile. Section 11 in both articles is the veterans restorative sentencing option. And I do want to note up front, this is also being carried in the Public Safety Conference Committee with identical language on both sides, although the proposals are similar, the Senate and the House. There are some substantive differences between the two proposals, and I wanted to highlight those for the committee. I haven't received any guidance as to who will be negotiating the differences, but for your situational awareness, one of the key differences in the Senate version is that it requires the consent of the victim, as well as the veteran and the prosecutor, to provide this restorative sentencing option. And let me back up. This, if you're not familiar with this provision, it would give veterans who suffered a service-related trauma that the court subsequently determines led to the veteran committing the criminal act. And this relates to PTSD, sexual trauma, traumatic brain injury, or substance abuse, or other mental health condition that the court determines is directly related to the veteran's military service, and then furthermore led to the offender committing the criminal act. And under both proposals, the offender and veteran would need to admit guilt, but then they would be eligible for this modified sentence that would ultimately, if they complete the terms of the imposed by the court, that the sentence would not be imposed on the person. So moving forward to the key differences, I mentioned that in the Senate, the veteran, prosecutor, and the victim need to agree to this sentencing option. That is not the case in the House. The House version allows the court to impose this or pursue this sentencing alternative on its own findings that it makes on its own determination. And building off of that key difference, the Senate goes further in providing more victim input
into the process. It allows for the victim to testify at a public hearing and weigh in on whether this is an appropriate sentence for the veteran. The one smaller but perhaps could be viewed as a significant difference is that the House requires substantial compliance with the terms of imposed on the veteran to comply with the sentencing, including drug treatment and other forms of treatment necessary to address the underlying problems, whereas the Senate only uses the word compliance. And then finally, the House requires the person to have successfully participated in treatment, while the Senate requires the person to have successfully completed that treatment. And that is a substantive difference that the veteran would need to prove that their service provider, treatment provider has found that they completed the treatment program. Mr. Gehring's operating the shared screen, and this will be moving forward. The side-by-side for this piece of the summary is several pages, so I'm going to jump all the way forward to page 7 of the side-by-side of these articles, which takes us to the last section of these two articles, and that's identical language in both the House and Senate. And this contains a revised instruction to renumber subdivisions related to the GI Bill modifications that I. Pending any questions, I'll move on to a series of articles that were authored by Representative Tu Zhang, who's on the committee today. And these are a series of agency proposals related to the Department of Military Affairs and the general to military justice within the National Guard. Article 8, which if you're on the side-by-side is on page R18, it contains three sections, the first of which relates to military personnel data, and it simply is trying to label the military personnel data as private data on individuals to protect it from public disclosure or those who don't need to know. The second section in Article 8 relates to the National Guard's members and inherently, it says here, is inherently federal data and intends to protect it from the Freedom of Information Act, rather, or it makes it, I'm sorry, let me state that more clearly. Therefore, the Freedom of Information Act would apply because it's federal data and not the Minnesota Data Practices Act. The final section in Section 8, it relates to the transfer of civil authorities. And this has to do with sharing criminal data between local authorities in Minnesota. And so if the state's staff judge advocate for the National Guard requests the data, it directs local police criminal justice authorities to share that regarding National Guard members to make sure that the National Guard has timely information. I think Mr. Diebel froze. Is Mr. Cotter from the Senate, are you able to carry on? It looks like Mr. Diebel is frozen. Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Chair, I actually might see Ms. Roberts is still on. She's able to do the policy. She staffs that committee and knows the detail better than I do.
Okay. Ms. Roberts, do you want to take a crack at it until we get Mr. Diebel back?
Mr. Chair, I can try. I'm sorry. Can you remind me where we are?
He was at, I believe, on this page 7 of 12. on the number three, section three there in the House side, I think the offenders transfer civil authorities. I think he was talking about that when he froze up.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I am somewhat familiar with these, but I basically would probably...
Mr. Chair, am I back on now?
You're back.
I can hear you now. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Mr. Deagle.
I'm sorry. My internet shows a very poor time to kick me off. So I'm on my phone now. So this has been proven to be a more reliable source of communication. But
I remember you were on number Article 3 on the House side about offenders. I think that's where you were at when you froze.
Yes, I was just about to move on to the Article 9, actually.
Okay.
And this relates to military judges. And again, this is just to go back to where we were. This is a part of the package of proposals that was brought forward by the Department of Military Affairs related to military justice. And this deals with finding qualified judges. This whole article deals with finding qualified military judges and military justice practitioners to come in to assist with the handling of military justice matters in the state. And it relates. So Section 1 establishes the criteria for a military lawyer who is not a member of the Minnesota Bar to practice in the state. And then Section 2 is a conforming change related to Section 3, and that broadens the group of military attorneys who may serve as military judges in the state. And then finally, Section 4 of Article 9 broadens the group of military attorneys who may serve as trial and defense counsel in military actions that relate to the National Guard in this state. Moving forward to Article 10, this is the article related to the Military Code of jurisdictional changes, and the Section 1 expands the application of personal jurisdiction over military members for purposes of the MCMJ, which is the Military Code of Minnesota Code of Military Justice. And then Section 2 is relates to the prosecute matters in the state. So it specifies the punitive articles of the United States Code of Justice. It brings in those articles, and that relates to the next article, which relates to Article 12, which imports conforming changes to the United States Code of Military Justice. Before I get to that, I do want to briefly talk about Article 11, which relates to military trial procedure. And this Section 1 is a technical change to make a cross-reference to the United States Code of Military Justice. And then the substantive change is contained in Subdivision 2, which relates to the statute of limitations. And that imposes the lesser of the Minnesota statute of limitation for an offense, the Minnesota Code of Military Justice statute of limitation, and the Federal Code of Military Justice. So if an offender is charged with an offense under those provisions, the statute of limitation that applies is the lesser of the statutes of limitations within those three provisions. Now, moving forward to the final section, which is entitled, articles titled Article 12, Military Sentences, contains a series of changes to the Military Code of Justice. Section 1 directs the courts martial convening authority to issue a final order at the end of a courts martial and promptly serve the order on the accused. The Section 2 clarifies the appeal process in courts martials. The Section 3 dictates the Minnesota Court of Appeals is the body that will review, the Minnesota Supreme Court shall review appeals under the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. And then Section 4 contains a conforming change to reflect the changes above. Now, we're going to move on to Article 3, which is the military punitive articles updates. Section 1 is details the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension as the agency that would be tasked with investigating criminal actions within the National Guard. Section 2 places limits on the sentences for violations of the Minnesota Code of Military Justice. And then Section 3 is a new offense which authorizes a courts martial for service members who are determined to be under the influence of a controlled substance while on duty. And again, I mentioned this earlier, these are conforming changes to reflect updates to the United States Code of Military Justice. Section 4 relates to search warrants and empowers any licensed peace officer in the state to execute a search warrant while a service member is in active service. Section 5 requires that enlisted members of the National Guard receive annual notice of the military's courts-martial authority over service members. This is intended to make sure that they understand their obligations to conform their activities and their actions with the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, and that they can't claim they were not aware of that requirement. Section 6 is a new offense to be added to the Minnesota Code of Military Justice, and it relates to activities of military recruiters and trainees or other persons in positions of trust and abuse of that authority, and that would be a new offense. The next section is a new offense as well, and it relates to the non-consensual distribution of intimate images, which often is referred to as revenge porn. Section 8 is a new offense, which is the fraudulent use of credit cards, debit cards, and other access devices. So that would be another grounds for a courts martial for a National Guard member in Minnesota. And then Section 9 is another new offense, which is the unauthorized use of government computer, again, which would subject the National Guard member who violates that to courts martial if they committed that activity while under the jurisdiction of the Code of Military Justice. Section 10 is another new offense, which relates to retaliating against a person for reporting a criminal offense or making a protected communication. So retaliation against someone would be a separate offense for the person who perpetrated that. And then to conclude the side-by-side summary is Section 11, which repeals a personal jurisdiction provision in the Minnesota Code of Military Justice that would no longer be needed if the other changes in this article are adopted. Mr. Chair, that concludes the summary of the Veterans and Military Affairs policy provisions. Unless you have any questions, I will allow you to move on to the next article.
I muted myself. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Any questions of this section, members? If not, Mr. Gehring, we can proceed to the next section.
So, Mr. Chair, the next article is a local government article, and my colleague, Chelsea Griffin, will take this one.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Griffin. And you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Chelsea Griffin, and I'm with House Research. So I'll be walking you through the local government policy article of the House language. This is Article 6. There's no comparable article in the Senate language, but there are notes here about whether or not language is traveling separately in other bills. So beginning with Sections 1 through 6, if you're following along in the side-by-side, this would be pages R1 dash A6 through R5. So these provisions update various provisions of the open meeting law, which is Chapter 13D, to reflect modern technology that's used for remote meetings of public bodies. There's updated language that's traveling in House File 820. This was amended and adopted by the Senate and adopted by the House on April 29th, and it's on its way to the governor now. Section 7, so this would be on page R5 of the side-by-side. This authorizes cities of the first class to enact an ordinance that requires a portion of land to be dedicated to the public for such purposes like parks, playgrounds, recreation, or to impose the dedication fee for such purposes on new construction. This only impacts the cities of Rochester and Duluth for now. The language in sections 21 and 22, so that's on page R12 of the side-by-side. Those are the special laws that already provide authority for the cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul for similar purposes, and those special laws are made notwithstanding the new language in section 7. Section 8 authorizes the Seaway Port Authority of Duluth to create a nonprofit corporation under Chapter 317A. Sections 9 through 10 authorize the towns or any political subdivision of the state with statutory sewer ownership or operational responsibilities to establish an INI program, that's the inflow and infiltration prevention programs. Section 11, which is R6 on the side-by-side, this authorizes county contracts up to $750,000 to be made by sealed bids or direct negotiation with certain county and state certified small businesses. Section 12 permits a city or town to adopt an ordinance requiring hotels in the municipality to have a municipal hotel license, which requires compliance with state and local laws. Section 13, this is a conforming change as a result of the repealer, which is section 23. So you can find the repealer on page R13 of the side-by-side. This repeals the compensation limit for political subdivision employees. And finally, sections 14 through 20, so this is pages R7 through R12 of the side-by-side. This updates various special law provisions that authorize the Duluth Entertainment and Convention Center. There is nearly identical language, just with one technical difference, in House File 1947, the first engrossment, which was passed by the House on April 29th, and also in the Senate Companion, which is 2029, the first engrossment, and that's received a second reading. Mr. Chair, that concludes the walkthrough of Article 6.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Griffin. And Mr. Gehring, does that complete our walkthrough, or do we have another section?
Mr. Chair, so that's the last article, so we've completed the entire policy walkthrough of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gehring. Thank you, everyone. Again, members, are there any questions before we go to testifiers? And I'll give a second or two here to make sure no one's jumping up there. If not, we'll start with our testifiers. And members, first person on my list is Sam Bonowitz from the Secretary of State's office. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Bonowitz. You can proceed with your testimony. Is Ms. Bonowitz?
Chair, this is Sam Bonowitz from the Office of the Secretary of State. Secretary Simon is actually here and available to testify.
Oh, okay. Very good. Secretary Simon, welcome to the committee. Proceed with your testimony. Identify yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you all hear me and see me okay?
Yes, I can see you.
Great.
And hear you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I really appreciate it. Mr. Chair, I just learned Friday of the invitation to be here. Thank you for it. I know I only have a couple of minutes, so I want to be respectful of your time. I've already given an overview of our office in both the State Government Finance Committees in both chambers before, so I won't get too detailed with you here today. I do want to say that the Office of the Secretary of State serves a vital function to people all across Minnesota, which is why I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for fully funding the Office of the Secretary of State to ensure that Minnesotans continue to receive the level of service that they've grown to expect from the office over the years. A fully funded office, of course, means that businesses across the state can continue to expect timely responses from our office as they prepare to start a business in Minnesota. It means that victims of domestic violence, stalking, or those who fear for their safety can continue to rely upon the Safe at Home program for an added layer of safety, reliably forwarding their mail in a timely manner. And of course, it means elections administrators in all 87 counties and hundreds of cities and townships can continue to count on the office to provide guidance, training, and support on the elections that are run around the state on a year-round basis. It's not just November every 2 years, as everyone I'm sure realizes on this conference committee. But most of all, I'm thankful for the investments that are made in some of these provisions in our democracy. In my view, provisions like automatic voter registration, restorations of rights for those who have left prison behind are common sense laws all across the nation that remove barriers to voting, and they have broad and growing bipartisan support, not just nationally, but here in Minnesota as well, and for all the right reasons. So in my view, we should be removing unnecessary barriers to voting, not imposing new ones, especially when the new proposed barriers are based on discredited rumors or conspiracies. I think that Minnesotans deserve better, and policy changes like automatic voter registration and restoration of voting rights take us forward, take us in the right direction. So it's my hope that members here today can agree on one thing, and that is that voting is a sacred and fundamental right that all eligible voters should be able to access regardless of race or ethnicity or economic circumstances or geographical location. So as always throughout this process, I'm available. Everyone on staff from our office is available to any one of you on this conference committee at any time should you have questions today, tomorrow, or in the future. I just want to thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Members, any questions? Not a very questioning group this morning. Thank you, Secretary Simon.
Thank you.
The next person I have on the list, I believe, is Ms. Maline from the AG's office. I believe she's here for Attorney General Ellison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, senators and representatives. First, Attorney General Ellison sends his deepest regrets for not being able to be here himself this morning, and thanks you for your time and your service. The AG asks the committee to adopt the House's position on the budget before you as it relates to the funding of the Attorney General's office. The governor's budget and the House's budget fund the AG's office at a level necessary to fulfill our statutory duty of representing over 100 state boards and agencies and protecting Minnesotans from fraudulent and deceptive business practices. In 2019, the AG's office received the first real dollar increase in three biennia. This modest boost was much appreciated, but we continue to fall far short of what is needed to fully serve Minnesotans' needs. In real dollars, the general fund appropriation to the Attorney General's office in 2018 was the same as it was in 2004 and 20% lower than it was in 2002. Despite that, not uncommonly, the office is a net contributor to the state. In recent years, the office has saved the state or returned to state coffers hundreds of millions of dollars. This has continued this year. So far in fiscal year 21, the office's lawsuits and settlements have generated over $90 million for the state's general fund. That includes an $81 million settlement with tobacco companies, among other consumer protection settlements. Additionally, the tobacco companies are required to pay the state an additional $10 million each year. In February, we also announced a nearly $8 million settlement with McKinsey for their involvement in the opioid epidemic. That money will go directly to abatement of the opioid crisis through the Opioid Advisory Council that the legislature established in 2019. The Office of the Attorney General also puts dollars directly back into the pockets of people and businesses. Last year, our Consumer Action Division returned $5 million to Minnesotans. Before you in the budget, we have six requests, all of which are included in the governor's and the House budgets. First is investment in technology. This includes e-discovery to help our staff search, organize, and locate key documents that help prove our case or allow us to defend lawsuits against state agencies. A centralized case management system designed to manage the 2,500 cases we handle per year. A charities database to help manage the more than 13,000 soliciting charitable organizations, 3,000 charitable trusts, and 400 professional fundraisers registered with our office, and a consumer complaints database to allow staff to serve Minnesotans far more efficiently. Secondly, investments in antitrust enforcement. Antitrust laws are designed to protect competition, allowing the marketplace to deliver superior goods and services to customers to consumers at a higher quality and lower price than a market without competition. Funding this request will increase our capacity to protect consumers and should have an impact on recovery of damages and civil penalties by the state. Third, investments in criminal enforcement. The AGO has not had the capacity to fully lend support in prosecuting violent or complex crimes, high impact white collar crimes, or cross-county crimes such as sex trafficking and financial exploitation. That's part of the reason the Minnesota County Attorneys Association supports our request. With additional resources, we will gradually rebuild the office's capacity to aid counties, almost always in greater Minnesota, to enforce the criminal laws in their jurisdiction. Fourth is wage theft. As part of the 2019 wage theft law, we sought funding from the legislature to ensure we had adequate staffing and resources to meet the new enforcement responsibilities. However, no such funding was provided. Nevertheless, we established a wage theft unit within the office and began to investigate, with our limited resources available, allegations of wage theft that we've received from the public and community. We currently do not have the staffing resources to investigate all meritorious allegations of wage theft that we received. Accordingly, we are renewing our request for funding. Fifth, security enhancements. The Attorney General's office staff have received threats to their safety as well as a direct result of doing their job enforcing the governor's emergency orders, prosecuting the murder of George Floyd, and handling various election cases. Additional funding is needed to ensure the security of staff at the AG's office, most of whom are located in rented space in downtown St. Paul. And finally, investments in recruitment and retention. We're seeking a very small increase that is the difference between our request in the 2019 session and what we were appropriated during the 2019 special session. Members, each one of these budget items is needed to allow the Attorney General's office to continue the work of delivering justice to the people of Minnesota and enforcing the law. Thank you, senators and representatives, for your time and commitment that each of you have put into crafting a budget. And Chair Nelson, it occurred to me I did not introduce myself at the beginning of my testimony. I am Carly Moline, Government Affairs Director for the Attorney General. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Moline. And members, any questions of the AG's office? Again, I'm a very quiet bunch this morning. Thank you again, Ms. Moline. The next person I have on my list is the state auditor, Ms. Blaha.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, and conference committee members. This is Julie Blaha, your state auditor. And as you work on this bill, let's remember the value of accountability.
I appreciate this opportunity to take a couple of minutes, and I'll even turn my timer on so we stick to that, to talk about the value of this office. The Office of the State Auditor, our oversight remedies and, even better, often prevents fraud, waste, and abuse in local government spending. For example, over the last 2 years, the USA found 76 material audit adjustments that corrected local government budgets by over $63 million. We facilitated the redistribution of $14.7 million in tax increment finance funds. Our investigations led to finding about $400,000 of stolen and misused funds and also resulted in numerous felony convictions. I could go on, but you have a lot of testifiers. Add that together with the education and direct support to local government officials we provide, that prevents fraud, waste, and abuse, and our work pays for itself many times over. Good oversight saves taxpayer dollars. Something else that doesn't show up on your spreadsheets is that our operating adjustment would be offset by 49% because of the fees we're required to collect from the entities that we audit. Now, the House proposal supports that work and allows us to fill only the most critical gaps in our oversight, and that is investigations, which we all know are more important than ever, support for townships. And one of the reasons we focused on this is because our townships, primarily in rural Minnesota, we believe deserve the same level of support and attention that counties and cities get. And then, of course, also oversight of school spending, something that we feel is a critical gap in the work that we're able to do right now. Now, on a technical note, I want to call your attention to the work we've done with the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials. On the fact sheet that we included with your materials today, we listed some of their concerns that came up when we were able to get a hearing on a similar bill in Senator Kiffmeyer's committee, and thank you again for that. They had some great suggestions, and in fact, they also have a suggestion for an amendment that really clarifies that these would be voluntary, and then along with the original language that was included in the governor's proposal, would make sure that this program is introduced in the least disruptive, most effective way possible. Now, if the Senate proposal is adopted, our office would need to lay off staff and cut the number of examinations we perform. Now, that's basically the difference between preventing fraud, waste, and abuse on one hand and increasing our risk on the other. So we urge this committee to choose a path that gives Minnesotans the oversight of their tax dollars that they expect and they deserve. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Blaha. Any questions for the state auditor? If not, thank you again. And the next person I have on my list is Commissioner Showalter. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. I appreciate the chance to testify before you today regarding the state government bill. It is obviously a challenge with the variety of issues that are under the committee's purview. Minnesota Management and Budget understands that variety. We serve all Minnesotans to make sure that state government is effective and transparent, fair, innovative, and striving to improve. And that requires a variety of activities and services. And bottom line is, I just want to assure you that we're all working together to make sure that we're improving the lives of Minnesotans. To begin with, I'm really pleased that several initiatives are included in the Senate and the House positions. That includes the Payment Plus program, which is an example of ways in which we're constantly looking for ways to innovate and create savings to benefit the general fund. Additionally, the bill provides MMB the flexibility and the ability to contract for the single audit, a necessity to ensure that we ensure we continue receiving federal funds. However, there are many aspects of both the Senate and House positions that compromise the ability of MMB and other state agencies to respond to the needs of Minnesotans. I am sending a detailed letter that gives you item-by-item information, so I will try to keep it really at a summary level in this testimony. Obviously, the first issue is just a key concern regarding MMB and other agencies in this bill is the reduction of agency budgets in the Senate's position. Agency operating budgets enable the executive branch to provide critical services in accordance to the laws passed by the legislature. Rather than asking MMB to build new innovative ideas like Payment Plus, the bill reduces overall resources to the agency by 7.8%, adds on new responsibilities with uncertain results. Now, let me provide a little detail on how the cuts would impact MMB. As you know, our agency provides a variety of services, including carrying out more than 1,800 statutory requirements, coordinating the budget and fiscal forecast, maintaining human resources and bargaining functions, managing $8 billion in public debt, paying thousands of vendors that supply goods, and these are just a few of the activities that we're responsible for. As part of this resource reduction, the bill requires the executive branch to also reduce the number of executive budget officers that we have by six. It's one of these positions are one of the best values of all of state government. Flexible, professional, and ask your own staff. But then a number of times in the importance of working together to get you the information that EVOs play for us. Reducing these functions only diminish the work that we do together. In contrast, the House position recognizes the contributions of state employees, and we thank you for that. As you know, it's been a long year for everybody, but state employees have in particular working tirelessly to serve Minnesotans. We're pleased that the House takes the governor's recommendation to increase operating budgets for MMB and other state agencies included in this committee. That allows us to maintain current operations and ensure there's not a reduction in those services. This brings me to the Senate's proposed limitation on the governor's peacetime emergency powers. The state is needed to respond quickly to the COVID-19 pandemic, and this executive discretion is precisely what is authorized by the Minnesota Emergency Management Act. The exercise of emergency powers to ensure the safety and well-being of Minnesotans needs to be tailored to the unique challenges presented. As we look going forward, the administration continues to look forward to working with the legislature to develop thoughtful modifications, but simply limiting the governor's ability to declare an emergency does not achieve that end. We're in unprecedented times, and reactionary changes aren't the right approach. I just need to note that the Senate position also includes a new approach to how the legislature reviews and approves federal funds, select federal funds. The bill strips away longstanding direction to the legislature on how to maximize and the direction to the executive branch to maximize the use of federal funds and replaces it with requirements for direct appropriations. This is a significant change for a state that already gets back less than it gets from the federal government. So I think these items need attention. Similarly, this isn't the time to add overly prescriptive management of state employees. We want to manage state employees. We want to get results. But we don't want to have a lot of litigation and trying to going back and forth about what exactly is meant. So whether we need to make sure that the insurer, the needs are, whether roads and bridges are safe, whether it's vital access to social services, support for learning in our schools, these are not easy objectives these days. They're not objective easy in most days. But right now, the positions create both new constraints for agency heads to manage the budgets and the people that power those results. We need to have an adequate workforce, and we need to make sure that ultimately we're continuing the core functions of state government. Arbitrarily linking the workforce numbers with the state's population, the location of their work, the ability to hold vacancies to adjust for other costs is contrary to the notion of managing for results, and we disagree with this approach, taken in several elements that are found in the Senate position and in one case in the House position. Both these positions contain several additional provisions that contain concern, but I'm going to save that for later, noting that we do have that longer letter available for you for future reference. But all that said, Mr. Chair, members, in conclusion, I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today, for your service and the work that you're going to be doing in committee in the coming week. As we engage in conference committee, just know that me, my staff, I look forward to working with you and are always available as questions come up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Showalter. The next person I have on my list, well, first, are there any questions of the commissioner? And again, I see no hands popping up. The next person on my list is Commissioner Robert Davis, Department of Administration. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you just fine.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Alice Roberts Davis. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Administration. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to address the conference committee today, and I look forward to a final conference report that works for all Minnesotans and creates efficient and accountable state government. I want to thank the chairs for their willingness to meet with admin and understand the critical needs of the department in order to deliver key administrative services to the broader state enterprise, as well as many other partners. Governor Walz's budget recommendations fund the essential operations of state government. These are investments that directly impact the livelihood of Minnesotans. The modest increases will reimagine how and where the state does work, maintain cherished public infrastructure, and provide better opportunities to Minnesota businesses looking to contract with state agencies. I'd like to thank both chairs for the inclusion of a number of the governor's recommendations impacting admin. In particular, each chamber recognizes the importance of funding the increase for in lieu of rent, which is the only source of dollars for operations and maintenance of the public, legislative, and ceremonial spaces on the Capitol complex, and the funding is critical to maintain the expected standard of care for the buildings. Additionally, there are several technical changes included in both bills that will clean up our statutes and assist admin's current work. Those are detailed in the letter that I provided to the committee. The House also includes appropriations to provide relief to the state parking fund and to cover a portion of projected compensation, health insurance, rent, and IT costs. The House bill also invests in a comprehensive real estate strategic plan for locating state agencies in support of agency space consolidation and relocation. I really hope the conferees will support these investments in a final conference committee report. The House bill also supports Minnesota's business community by leveraging federal funds from the U.S. Department of Defense for the Procurement Technical Assistance Center, which works with building capacity for targeted group, economically disadvantaged, and veteran-owned businesses. It also addresses Minnesota's economic and health disparities through its investments in promoting greater health equity and public grants awards in management. However, admin does have some concerns and suggestions to improve both versions of the bill. Unfortunately, the budget cuts in the Senate bill would make it impossible for the department to effectively deliver its statutory mandated services. The permanent $300,000 general fund cut is not only unsustainable, but is compounded by newly mandated services and provisions that I will talk about more momentarily. That cut will be further intensified by the lack of debt service relief for the parking fund necessary due to parking contract cancellations during the pandemic. Parking services on the Capitol complex are entirely user financed, and without the temporary debt service relief, parking rates will increase on the Capitol complex to cover debt service and operations. Admin suggests a modification to the House's prohibition on contracts with vendors who used forced labor from the Uyghur region of China. These types of prohibitions are extremely difficult and resource intensive to administer, as admin would need to have insight into the complete supply chain of every company that enters into a state contract over a certain dollar amount. A preferred alternative that would still achieve the objective would be to have vendors certify or attest to compliance as part of the contract and setting the dollar amount at a formal contracting level of $50,000. Admin also suggests adding the ability to waive the provision if ever the rare circumstance occurs where the state has no other contracting option. This exception would align the statute with other similar contracting prohibitions. I also want to highlight several concerning provisions related to the SHPO and the Senate language that has SHPO assuming the management of nearly half of the state's historic sites. Such a duty is far outside the SHPO's expertise and its federally and state mandated duties. There's also no funding included to support this major shift of control and operations. My letter to conferees further elaborates on problematic SHPO language with which we would like to work on resolving. Finally, I strongly caution against the mandating of using a reverse auction procurement method for the pharmacy benefit manager. The reverse auction process requires rigid specifications from which all responders submit pricing. This methodology does not allow for proposals that add innovation or address unique supply chain constraints. Key lessons learned from previous extensive use of reverse auctions, where the process often does not result in the lowest cost available. Vendor participation fell off over time, with more than 100 auctions canceled due to insufficient vendor participation. And Minnesota experienced a number of contract defaults by vendors that were unable to honor the bid commitments they made through the online process. The best value procurement method allows for agility, negotiations, and creative solutions proposed by the vendor community. Admin recommends that the best value process is used for this particular procurement. Should the conference committee wish, I would love to provide further detail when appropriate. The department is prepared to work with the conferees on the issues I've just outlined. Again, I'd like to thank you for your consideration, and I, along with my fellow admin team members, look forward to working with the conferees and would answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Davis-Roberts. Roberts Davis, I got it backwards. Any questions?
Okay.
Representative Mason.
Chair, I don't know what would be the appropriate time, but just, you know, when we were going through the side-by-side as well as some of the comments from the current testifier, it seems we need to spend maybe a little bit more time sometime discussing the transfer of SHPO to this agency, and it sounds like there are a number of, how would I put it? I don't know if it's overly efficient, but maybe we need to talk about the differences and what that change involved.
Can you do that, Representative? Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair.
I was gonna say, Representative Mason, that when we get to that part where the differences are, we'll probably have a broader discussion on that. And at that time, we probably will have Ms. Davis here and have the Historical Society here to discuss that.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
Any other questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Roberts-Davis. And the next person I have on my list is Commissioner Doty from the Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Chair Kiff.
Well, welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and for the important work you're doing to fund essential services provided by state agencies across Minnesota. For the record, my name is Robert Doty, Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. We appreciate the committee's work to review proposals throughout the session and look forward to continuing these discussions during conference committee. However, I'm here today to voice the department's concerns about House File 1952, Senate File 1831, the Omnibus State Government Finance Bill. As you know, the IRS in Minnesota opened the 2021 individual income tax filing season on February 12th. As previously announced, the Department of Revenue is extending a grace period to Minnesota taxpayers who will now have the opportunity to file and pay their income taxes penalty and interest free until May 17th. To date, the department has received about 2.2 million individual income tax returns and sent out 1.3 million refunds. The department works year round to provide a variety of services to customers around the state. As drafted, both versions of the state government finance bill make reductions to the Department of Revenue's general fund appropriation. The House bill makes a cut of $2.4 million over the biennium, and the Senate bill cuts $28.3 million over the biennium from the governor's recommendation. Both of these proposals will negatively affect our ability to maintain the current level of services we provide to Minnesotans, and will reduce the amount of money the department collects to fund vital state government programs. Reductions will also impact the department's ability to maintain required support for technology systems efficiently process and protect private taxpayer data. Cuts to revenue will have a directly negative impact on Minnesotans. Our resources fund our customer outreach and education and the tax administration system. The department cannot absorb the appropriation reduction and needs an operating increase to maintain our current service levels. An operating reduction will negatively impact our ability to administer the state tax system. This is not a situation where the department would be able to do more with less. There would be significant consequences for customers if this reduction is enacted. Customers will wait longer for refunds because we will need to process 3.1 million individual income tax returns, process 2.5 million pieces of mail, and send out 2.1 million individual income tax refunds with fewer resources and staff. Minnesotans will have a harder time reaching someone in the department by phone or email to have their questions answered. COVID-19, the various tax law changes at the federal level, and those being proposed at the state level have created one of the most complex tax filing seasons in recent history. With a reduction in resources, customers will experience longer response times on the over 518,000 customer requests we receive in a typical year via phone, email, web services, and in-person visits. We will not be able to update information on our website as quickly and will publish fewer revenue notices and revenue analyses. The Department of Revenue will have fewer audits and enforcement activities that address patterns of noncompliance to ensure a fair tax system for all. This, in turn, could affect the revenue we bring in. With these reductions, the department would have to reduce its existing investments in strong and efficient technology and cybersecurity systems and reduce our ability to quickly respond to evolving tax and identity fraud efforts. We would like to thank the House for including the compliance provisions to align Minnesota with background check requirements of IRS Publication 1075. This is an important provision that revenue needs and is also carrying on behalf of the Departments of Human Services, Employment, Economic Development, and MNSHR that will enable agencies to maintain access to federal tax information, which is vital for agencies' work. We urge you to include this provision in the final conference committee report. Finally, we appreciate the funding included in each proposal for the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, or VITA. Through this program, thousands of low and moderate income tax filers receive free tax support from trained and certified volunteers across the state who help people claim income-boosting tax credits and meet their tax obligations. The governor's budget recommendation included a total of $1.1 million for the VITA program, $1 million in grant funding, and $100,000 for internal support to build program capacity. The capacity building funding was specifically set aside in the governor's recommendation so the department would be able to build capacity within the VITA field and subsequently support new and current VITA providers in order to expand free tax preparation options in Minnesota. The current Senate language appropriates $600,000 for grants and nothing for program support. The House language appropriates the full $1 million for grants, but does not include the $100,000 for program support. We urge you to include the full funding for grants and program support in your final omnibus proposal. This program is vital to supporting low and moderate income tax filers around the state, and we appreciate your consideration. Chair Nelson and Chair Kiffmeyer and members of the committee, again, thank you for letting me speak with you today, and I'm happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Doty. Any questions for Commissioner Doty? Seeing no hands popping up on my screen. Again, thank you, Commissioner. And we'll proceed with our next person on the list. I have Commissioner Tomes from Minute. One second before we go, before you leave, Mr. Doty, represent our Senator Carlson. You have a question.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. We've mentioned a couple of times that you know we don't have the questions available, or the questions available right now, and potentially the answers could be longer. And you mentioned that we'll be able to bring some of the people back, maybe the commissioners back. How do you plan on orchestrating that so that we can have the maybe more specific testimony and question and answers with the commissioners in future meetings?
I think that's a question for both myself and Chair Kiffmeyer. I think as we head onto the different sections, as we work on them, we may be asking the different commissioners to have somebody here that can answer questions or give better answers. We'll have to see that as we go through the committee and through the coming days. The big thing right now is we're going to have to wait till we get our target set to us from the speaker and from the majority leader, and so that we know how much money we'll have to spend and where we could, and then we can have our discussions about where to divide that out. Is that satisfied?
Certainly, it's all we can do right now. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, Mr. Chair, I think what you said is good. We'll have to wait for the targets because the targets make a big part of the conversation, so it's a little hard to discuss. But I really appreciate right now just hearing their general comments, and also their detailed letters are very helpful and have a lot of information in those letters.
Thank you, Chair Kiffmeyer. If no other questions, the next person on the list I have here is Commissioner Tomes for Minute. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, and good morning. Just want to make sure you can hear me okay.
I can hear you fine.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, and committee members. For the record, my name is Tarek Tomes, and I am the Commissioner of Minnesota IT Services and the State Chief Information Officer. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. We have all seen the critical impact technology has had across the globe, certainly in our country, and we look forward to working with this conference committee to address the needs and the expectations of Minnesotans from their state government in the area of information technology. While we recognize the challenging task put before this committee, I would like to stress the importance of continued investment in the state's digital capabilities at such a critical time. Technology has performed a central role in enabling the state of Minnesota's pandemic response and economic recovery efforts. And this was possible in large part because of the close collaboration between Minute, our state agency partners, and our partners in the private sector, including members of the Governor's Blue Ribbon Council on Information Technology. In alignment with the Blue Ribbon Council's recommendations, Minute is seeking to harness that spirit of innovation to more rapidly advance the maturity of IT project capabilities across state government, empowering the transformation of state government's service delivery. The state's IT project portfolio includes over 300 projects, equating to roughly $250 million in total spend. This portfolio represents a tremendous opportunity to modernize how the state interacts with Minnesotans. For this reason, we ask that you support the governor's recommendation to fund the implementation of the Blue Ribbon Council recommendations in the area of IT project delivery and digital government services to ensure that the value of the state's investment in this portfolio is maximized to better serve all Minnesotans. An overall reduction in Minute's current funding levels, as contained in the Senate bill, would negatively impact Minute's ability to perform our mandated IT leadership role, not only in the area of IT project delivery, but in the area of cybersecurity as well, at a time when technology has become even more central to the daily lives of Minnesotans and the operations of state government. Over the past year, governments and organizations across the world have been tested by an unprecedented pandemic that has pushed the limits of technology. And here in Minnesota, technology has performed a central role in enabling the state of Minnesota's pandemic response and economic recovery efforts. A few examples of highly successful digital service opportunities just from the last 12 to 18 months. At the Department of Public Safety in their driver's license division, Minnesotans can renew a driver's license online for the first time in Minnesota history. As of this morning, over 330,000 Minnesotans have renewed their driver's licenses online, an incredible transformation and opportunity for Minnesota citizens. Pandemic emergency food benefits. We found new ways to engage with Minnesotans, sending text messages to alert them of new emergency food benefits. As of April, we have sent over 1 million text messages in multi-languages to alert people that they have a new benefit in their emergency food benefits, enabling to provide much needed support for their families. Unemployment insurance, nation leading efforts in the unemployment insurance space. We've had over 47 million logins to the unemployment insurance system from January to March of 2021. Over 1.1 million accounts have been created in the unemployment insurance space. Vaccine data, dashboards that have driven a transparent approach to how Minnesota is doing from a vaccination effort, both from a provider perspective as well as how Minnesota's vaccine rollout has proceeded across the state. The vaccine connector tool that was launched, enabling thousands of Minnesotans to find vaccine opportunities in their region. We created a mobile option for our homeless veterans registry that allows people in the field to provide critical services for veterans. And certainly another really broad example that was on display continually during the pandemic is payless and touchless payment options in our natural parks, in our state parks, that allowed visitors during a pandemic to still transact in a manner that was safe. All of these examples underscore the power of technology to improve how Minnesotans interact with their state government, particularly in a time of emergency. Gartner, a leading technology research firm, expects global technology investments to surpass $4.1 trillion, an increase of 8.4% from 2020. Cyber attacks increased by 20% in 2020 to the highest total ever, and certainly in Minnesota, we saw abundant examples of that. In addition to investments to meet increased demand for services, the need for continued cybersecurity investment remains critical. Like many public and private organizations across the world, Minnesota government has seen how critical and essential investments in digital capabilities truly are. As we emerge from this pandemic, it is my hope that we see a broad recognition that digital capabilities that work for all Minnesotans are both fundamental and necessary to effective government operation. Lastly, I would like to thank members from both bodies for the inclusion of Minnesota's statutory cleanup provisions in both bills, which will help modernize Minnesota's enabling statutes and remove outdated and contradictory language. Thank you, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, and committee members for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions and certainly will be available as well as my staff throughout this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner Tolmes. Any questions? Seeing no hands popping up on my screen. Again, thank you, Commissioner. The next person I have on my list is Commissioner Herkey of the Veterans Affairs. Welcome to the committee and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer. I am Larry Herkey, the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I thank you for the opportunity to come in front of you this morning to further explain some of the impacts and to thank the committee members as it relates to many of the items that were included as part of both the Senate and the House bills. To begin with, on the policy side, I want to thank both sides of the House and the Senate for including the authorization for adult daycare. This is something we've been doing for years, and this just allows positive authority for that. The same thing in the area of dental care for our residents. This has been a big plus for our residents, and again, thank you for both including this in the omnibus bill. Commissioner Tolmes had talked about the Stable Housing Initiative, or we call it the Veterans Registry, has helped over 2,200 veterans to find safe, secure housing. And we just, again, would like a little more help and assistance in there. And you've included it in both your bills to be able to share information, especially within state government. Also for the technical corrections to the GI Bill. And lastly, the Veterans Sentencing Guidelines and Veterans Restorative Justice Act. I know there's many parts to that, and as I listen through the side-by-sides, there's a lot of differences between the state and the House. I can tell you from the Veterans Service Organizations who speak to me through the Commander's Task Force and also the Governor's Office and the agency are all in support of the House bill. So I'd ask maybe that you'd start there and then negotiate any needed changes. But if the House bill seems like the one that that most, especially the veteran service organizations, are very in line with. I was also going to say the requirement to add prevention to the Veteran Suicide Awareness Day. We support, Governor's Office supports that, the agency supports that, and I'm ready as commissioner to do my responsibilities as it outlines in that area. I'd like to shift away from policy and into appropriations. And in the appropriations, there's about a $9 million difference between the House and the Senate bill. Generally, we're supportive of the House bill in all respects, but I do want to say thank you to both House and Senate for including all items, I think, that we've presented here. Specifically, the Veteran Suicide Prevention Program, which is new to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. We have between 100 and 120 veterans that take their lives each year, and it is fully funded in both sides, so I appreciate that very much. The second item is going to touch on the large difference between the operating budget adjustment, and again, the House bill would be more in line with the requirements to meet and keep the staff that we currently have on, especially in the healthcare area. With the Senate version, there would be significant reductions in healthcare that would be required to meet that level of funding. We did have a one-time request for 9/11 Remembrance Task Force. It's the 20th anniversary. We're looking at, writing the definitive history, a remembrance ceremony, and also an educational component that would include a traveling exhibition to help to teach individuals, Minnesotans, about what impacts the veterans have made since 9/11. Probably one of the most important items, we're making significant progress in the area of veterans' homelessness. There was a request for housing vouchers and wraparound services. We find that this is the most successful way of moving people. There's been a group of about 139 veterans that have been on for quite a while, way longer than 90 days, some of them years, waiting for some type of help and assistance to get them into housing first so that they can turn their lives around. A lot of these veterans right now are in temporary housing or other accommodations, but really need some help to get them off the veterans registry list. The one item not included as the agency request was the personal needs allowance. It was discussed earlier. This is actually in the House bill, but it was brought to us through Senator Bingham in Hastings, and we think there's support on both sides of the aisle for this. Right now, the amount paid to the domiciliary folks is $90 per year. That has not been adjusted since 1996. And we're suggesting that we match the Minnesota Department of Human Services, or DHS. They have a distribution schedule, which would increase that to $105 and then would take it up as the cost of living increases. So we just follow that going forward. We're not asking for any additional money there, but we would just absorb the $27,000 as part of our current budget for healthcare. And with the last item I had was in the area of good news. Actually, we received $80 million in federal funding for federal grants as it related to the three new homes in Preston, Montevideo, and in Bemidji. Those homes will be starting on those this fall. It will require some funding, and I think the governor's submitted a supplemental for $337,000 in FY22 and approximately $8.3 million in FY23. This is to bring the staff on, and we will be fully functional in the second part of fiscal year 23 in all three homes. Again, the design is complete, property is being transferred, and the funding was provided by both the legislature and the through the federal grants program, plus the local contributions are all in place. So that's good news, but it will require an adjustment to my operating budget also for that going forward. And with that, my staff will stand ready as you go forward, or myself, to meet again if needed. And I just want to thank the members of the committee for taking time to listen to my testimony today, and I stand for any questions you might have.
With that, members, are there any questions for Commissioner? Seeing no hands popping up on the screen, thank you, Commissioner Herkey. And we'll proceed with the next person on my list. The next person I have on my list is Shannon Geshek from the Minnesota Council, or Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. Welcome to the committee. Please state just your name for the tape. Is Ms. Geshek on the here? Is Mr. Reich here? On the list. A lot of people on the list here. If not, we will invite her back at a later date. On my agenda here, it says Mr. Don Kerr is here, the Executive Director of Military Affairs. He's here to answer any questions. Mr. Kerr, did you need to testify?
Mr. Chair, really, I'm Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. I guess since you called me and I'm unmuted, I'll take just a few seconds to thank you, thank Chair Kiffmeyer and the members for the support to the agency. Major General Mankey is flying to Washington this morning, so he couldn't be here. But we really appreciate the support and funding the governor's request in both chambers, and want to encourage the conferees to consider adding Articles 8 through 13 in the House bill. Those are all amendments that we are asking for to make the Minnesota Code of Military Justice more usable for us, to enable us to commit to maintain good order and discipline in the National Guard. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand by for any questions anyone may have.
Thank you, Mr. Kerr. Any questions? Again, okay, the next person I have on my list is Mr. Whitworth from the Historical Society. Mr. Whitworth, welcome to the committee. State your name for the tape.
My name is Kent Whitworth. I serve as the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, and members of the conference committee for the opportunity to testify. I want to first thank the House and Senate chairs and committees for supporting Minnesota Historical Society operations in the state government finance bills. These funds will allow MNHS to continue our service to the public across the state of Minnesota, just as we've done for more than 170 years in partnership with the state of Minnesota. For all Minnesotans, this past year has been a challenge, and we look forward, especially this year, to welcoming visitors back, in addition to continuing the virtual programming we've offered over the past year. This morning, I'd like to comment specifically on the provisions in the Senate bill that would remove operations of state-owned historic sites from the Minnesota Historical Society. We are opposed to these provisions found in Section 68, 69, and 74. Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee, for more than 50 years, the Minnesota Historical Society has successfully operated this network of historic sites for both the education and the enjoyment of Minnesotans and visitors to Minnesota. We have diligently cared for 150 structures at these historic properties, and we've welcomed millions of visitors, school children, families, and tourists, all seeking to learn more about our history. This proposal would be both inefficient and confusing to the visiting public, with two different organizations running historic sites under different systems. As we all know, history is often complex, and at the Minnesota Historical Society, we work hard to share this history in a fair and thoughtful manner. Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, and members of the conference committee, we respectfully request that you not move forward with the proposal to remove state-owned historic sites from the operations of the Minnesota Historical Society. We look forward to working with the conference committee to answer any questions you may have on the service that the Minnesota Historical Society provides to the citizens of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whitworth. Any questions for the Historical Society? Seeing none, the next person I have on my list is Mr. Glazer, CEO of Ampers. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, and members. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer, and I am the CEO of Ampers Diverse Radio for Minnesota's Communities. We represent 18 independent community radio stations throughout Minnesota that are not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio or Minnesota Public Television. Our stations primarily serve underserved communities. We define underserved as Native American, African American, new immigrants, and those living with a disability. These stations have played and are playing a crucial role in getting critical information to these diverse communities during the pandemic. Our request of you today is very straightforward. We are simply asking that you support the House position of our bill. We are trying to get our funding level back to where it was on a per station basis before we got cut in FY18. The House position does exactly that by adding $125,000 to our FY23 allocation. I know in the state government finance budget, that may not seem like much, but it makes a big difference for the small, diverse community radio stations that we support, diverse community radio stations, which also play an important role in many of your districts and to your constituents. And with that, Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, I'm available should there be any questions, but we ask that you do support the House position.
Thank you, Mr. Glazer. Any questions? Members, we're getting close to the end here. We have to be off. I'll take one more testifier. The next person on my list is Mr. Beck. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. And then after that, Chair Kiffmeyer has a few things she wants to say. Mr. Beck.
Chair Nelson, Chair Kiffmeyer, thank you very much. My name is George Beck. I'm a retired administrative law judge, a former chair of the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board, and presently chair of Clean Elections Minnesota. My nonprofit strongly supports the long overdue restoration of the right to vote for released felons. We also support automatic voter registration that will simplify registration for citizens and make it less costly. And we need to end a dark money loophole in Minnesota by expanding the definition of expressly advocating, as 19 other states have already done. The Secretary of State should be authorized to mail ballots to registered voters without a request. Many states do this successfully. All of these provisions will support and expand voting in our state, which should be the goal of this legislature for a successful and thriving democracy. But we ask that you do not include the provisional ballot language and a prohibition on ranked choice voting in the final legislation. It's unnecessary in Minnesota and has an unknown cost. During the committee process, supporters emphasized that some 40 other states had adopted provisional ballots. What wasn't mentioned was that this didn't happen because the states thought this was the best method for voting. The federal government required states to adopt it. Minnesota, on the other hand, was exempt because we had same-day registration.
Mr. Beck, if you want to wrap up, and I have to leave some time for Chair Kiffmeyer.
I will, Mr. Chair. This bill, this proposal for provisional balloting will discourage voting. When potential voters learn that they can't register and vote on election day, that will discourage voting. There was no evidence in committee to show that our present day same day registration process has been abused. And normally data supports legislation, but not here.
Mr. Beck, I need to go to Chair Kiffmeyer. If you want to come back tomorrow or the next day and testify again, you can put your name back on the list. But we're running out of time here, and I have to leave time for Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you.
Sorry about that. Senator Kiffmeyer, you wanted a few minutes at the end here.
Thank you very much, Chair Nelson. I appreciate that. So tomorrow, the Senate will have the gavel, and we'll continue taking testimony all morning. And so anybody who wants to sign up to speak to any of the issues that are currently in front of us to share their perspective or their viewpoints, make comments as they would like to do, as you've heard from testifiers today. So that is what we will be doing tomorrow, is continuing to take that testimony. So I just wanted to be sure, Mr. Chair, that all the folks listening today, and also that it's a public announcement of the agenda, which we did post with the announcement of the conference committee hearing tomorrow. That's already been posted, and that was part of the agenda. Just want to confirm that. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
And Mr. Chair, I think when they want to sign up to testify, because the Senate has the gavel, we would need to have them submit their names to Mr. Alec Bjorn. It is on the conference committee website. If they would please do that. So Mr. Beck, if you want to reapply your name, send it to Mr. Alec Bjorn, the committee administrator for the Senate State Government Committee. And also, I make a request, Chair Nelson, if you have any testifiers that were not able to get on today, that Ms. Rudolph and Mr. Bjorn work together to make sure that those requests come forward to tomorrow morning.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Yeah, and I was going to say the same thing. I have like another 13 people, including Mr. Beck, on the list that we weren't able to get to today. Please, I will have my committee assistant, Amanda Rudolph, forward those names to Alec, and we will then, and but I would also suggest that everyone that didn't get a chance to testify today to contact Mr. Bjorn or Alec. I might not have his last name correct, but anyway, if they would contact him to get their name on the list, and then we'll proceed with testimony with that tomorrow. And members, thank you for your time this morning. And with that, I think I said, like as Senator Kiffmeyer, Chair Kiffmeyer said, what we're going to be doing tomorrow. Please forward your, if you want to talk, forward your name. If you haven't weren't on the list today and you want to be at it tomorrow, contact the Senate. And with that, members, unless there's anything else, it's 12 o'clock. We are adjourned.